Thank you, Radio's Ryan Burrow. Hi, everybody. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder. It's Wednesday.
We're getting funky.
Kind of. Not overly, but just enough, I think, right? If you want to dial us up, please do. 312-981-7200. You could use that as a phone line or a text line, whichever you prefer.
Top of the morning to you, and happy Humper.
And to you. And to yours.
Thank you very much.
You know what I saw today that is very disturbing to me? I'm sure at some point when you were growing up, you probably, maybe on a vacation, maybe not, you and your family probably dined at a Howard Johnson's restaurant.
Howard Johnson's. We had a big Howard Johnson song.
You guys had a song to commemorate your visits to Howard Johnson?
I will tell you, on our various family vacations when we weren't getting hit by a semi or other things like that, we stayed at the Howard Johnson's Motor Lodge
all the time.
Yeah. Wasn't it turquoise and orange, kind of like the Miami Dolphins colors?
Exact colors of the Miami Dolphins. Exact.
And that's when I was on my big Miami Dolphins kick.
Well, that was when they were in their prime. K-I-I-C-K.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the Dolphins were in their prime.
Right.
They had the season where they went undefeated.
Larry Zonka
was on the team. But for some reason, and I know people must have eaten in Howard Johnson's in their own towns, but for some reason, Howard Johnson's was the official restaurant and sometimes hotel of being out of town.
Absolutely.
Like, anytime we went anywhere, it was a given. If we went to Michigan or Wisconsin or Indiana, wherever we would go, it's a guarantee that at least one day you'd have lunch or dinner or both at a Howard Johnson's. Well, here's some sad news. Are you ready? Howard Johnson's in Bangor, Maine is closing. This will leave just one Howard Johnson's left in the entire country.
Where is it? We have to do a road trip. Howard Johnson's, a Howard Johnson's.
Now, is that just a song your family created?
Yes.
Okay, because I was wondering, why don't I know that song? But
you know,
it was only in your
it
family.
It was so exciting to get to the hotel after the long drive to Florida. So we were very excited,
yeah,
and we came up with the Howard Johnson's.
I could understand that.
Very creative.
I could see that. I'm trying to think of their logo. I know there was a boy and a chef involved, right? Wasn't there a kid, like, looking up at a chef, like, as if to say, I'm finally here. I finally made it to Howard Johnson's. I've waited all year for my family to take a trip, and now I'm here. And if you're a chef, why are you working at Howard Johnson's?
That's a good point. but they were very inexpensive to stay there.
Oh,
and they were nice.
Everything about them.
They had a nice machine.
They did have a nice machine, didn't they? Was that the barometer by which your family decided to stay at a hotel?
And a connected restaurant.
Yeah, they always had that.
That's very important.
They always had that. There's an episode of Mad Men in their second or third to last season, where Don Draper is in a Howard Johnson's, and whoever did the set design that day should win some sort of an award, because you really went back in time.
Really?
They captured every minute detail, you know, from the people who were eating there in and around Don Draper. Even, like, when you would go there, I'm sure you noticed this too, it was one of those restaurants where you got a little bit of everything. You had well-dressed businessmen who were having some sort of a meeting at the Rotary Club and decided to have lunch there. You had kids that just came in all screaming and just screamed the whole time they were there.
I believe I had a tank top and plaid shorts on at the time and a Dutch boy haircut.
Oh, that's the official look of a Howard Johnson's.
I know, and I was the kid who always ordered the fried chicken, and they always said, you know, it's going to take 40 minutes. And I'm like, I don't care. And everybody else was like, really?
I'm on vacation. Take 2 hours if you like. I've got time. It's my vacation.
Howard Johnson's, you brought back some.
There's only one
memories.
Left. It says the closing of one of the last two Howard Johnson's restaurants in a couple of weeks will mark the end of its fried clam strips.
Oh, yeah.
Remember those?
I
couldn't
do.
Escape that aroma from the time you walked in. You smelled those fried clam strips. Their ice cream, which I think is still, like, I see it every once in a while in a grocery store. There'll be, like, a couple of odd flavors of Howard. So they're still selling
that.
Yeah. I don't know why you would just buy the ice cream. There's much better ice cream out there, I hate to admit.
Again, but I think it came with your dinner, so you would.
You're right.
And it would come in a little, like, parfait cup with
a
foot on the bottom. You know what I'm talking about?
Do.
And it wasn't even that good, but it was free ice cream.
Who could say no? And other menu staples that nourished baby boomers and leave the once proud restaurant chain teetering on the brink of extinction. A slice of roadside Americana will no longer be serving up in Bangor, Maine as of the date of September the 6th. For waitress Kathy Jewett, it's the only job she's held starting work when the restaurant opened back in 1966. She's been there since 1966, 50 years on the job at Howard Johnson's. I wonder if she looks haggard and tired.
No.
No, probably not. I bet she looks as fresh as the day is long. It's bittersweet, says Kathy, but it's nothing to be sad about, the 68-year-old Jewett insisted on Tuesday. Wow. So, all right, she was there from the time she was 18 until now, 68.
That's loyal.
That's loyal. Did you ever see the movie Goodbye, Mr. Chips about the British teacher who's been there for 50 years? This is like the Goodbye, Mr. Chips of Howard Johnson's.
Goodbye, Mrs. Chocolate Chips.
That's what they'll call it if they make it into a movie. I hope Meryl Streep is listening. I've been here for 50 years, and it's time. Boy, that sentence says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because without coming right out and saying it, I get the feeling Kathy Jewett is almost glad that they're closing.
Because she wouldn't have left.
She's too loyal to have left. She's way too loyal. It took the chain deciding, well, let's close it down. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
In 1925, Howard Deering Johnson bought a drugstore soda fountain, opening a second store in 1927, a third in 1928, and in 1935... He created the first modern restaurant franchise, charging a fee to allow operators to use the soda shop's name.
That's brilliant.
That really is.
There was none of that. They didn't license out restaurants until this guy. That's brilliant. I wonder if he also charged former New York Met and Cub outfielder Howard Johnson to use that name. He definitely should have. The only one left now, as the one in Maine comes to a close in September, is in Lake George, New York.
We've got to go.
I would go there. I would definitely go. Before falling on hard times, Howard Johnson took restaurant franchises to a new level, as you just pointed out. The orange-roofed eateries once numbered more than 800. Boy, what a decline. At one point, you had 800 of these things.
By 1965, Bill, there were 770 restaurants and 265 motels.
Wow.
And this is when the interstates were just starting to go, so really a genius move on this guy's part.
Their placement was flawless. When we used to go, my great-grandparents lived in Detroit, and we would see them at least once a year, sometimes two or three times a year. And there was never a time when I was growing up, there was never one single trip that we didn't go at least once on the way there and at least once on the way back.
Remember the Hojo soda?
Yeah, I do remember it.
It was
actually
just orange and root beer, but it was their own brand.
Yeah, I do remember that. They had it in cans for a while or in the fountain service.
A lovely gift shop in every Howard Johnson's as well. You know how many keychains I bought?
And then there's something else about Howard Johnson's that only I seem to remember. I've brought this up on the show in the past, and nobody remembers this but me. We'll come back and I'll tell you this.
Perfect.
All right, stick around, a little bit more talk. It's a little sad. One of the two remaining Howard Johnson's is closing. Call in if you like at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. All right, we're talking about, and I will warn you right now, this isn't a happy time. There's two Howard Johnson's restaurants / motor lodges remaining in the United States, and that's today. The first week of September, the one in Bangor, Maine, closes, leaving just one Howard Johnson's in the entire nation. That'll be located in Lake George, New York.
It's really sad, and I think Jan has a great idea. Only one Howard Johnson's left, Jan. What should we do?
I think you should have Steve Bertrand, because he has his travel company.
Steve Bertrand
now.
Travel.
Right.
Yeah.
Steve Bertrand Travel. Design a trip. And all the fans can go for one last time and eat the ice cream and take photo ops and just have a great time. I think you guys would be great traveling companions.
Wouldn't that be fun?
And
you would go. You'd go, Jan, right?
I would go.
Would you wait the 45 minutes so they could make my fried chicken?
Absolutely. I can imagine the conversations we would have, Wendy. We would talk about Leaf Baby and talk about Tiki and Star Wars and all that good stuff.
Oh.
All right. Well, let's do it.
Okay.
We'll put it together. We'll talk to Steve Bertrand at Steve Bertrand Travel and see what he can come up with.
I can't wait to hear that promo.
How do you like that? Tell him he got some free advertisement here.
I know. All right. Well, thanks, Jan. Great idea.
Hey, love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Here's what they had at the counter of every Howard Johnson's. And I swear, I have mentioned this on the show three or four times over the years. Nobody ever knows what I'm talking about. But they used to have this big stand-up display. It would be about a foot to a foot and a half high. and it had lollipops.
I remember that.
And they were just, they were chocolate and vanilla lollipops. So they started out vanilla, but then whatever the picture was on the lollipop, sometimes it was a cityscape. Sometimes it was Santa Claus. Sometimes it was a car. The one that I cherished and I kept because I wanted to have it forever, but it melted away, was Batman and Robin. The profiles of Batman and Robin were on this Howard Johnson's lollipop. But every time you went in on the display, they had 45 or 50 different ones, all the same flavors, vanilla with the chocolate covering of the picture. But I'd buy one, and I kept that Batman and Robin. I had it for like a week, and then, you know, that stuff doesn't last forever.
You should have just put it in the freezer.
I should have put it in the freezer. I should have.
I recall the lollipop stand.
Display?
Yeah, but I didn't recall that they were chocolate. I thought they were just your average orange,
cherry. No, they didn't have the flavors. They were all that, like, it started vanilla, but then the picture was in chocolate. And they weren't great, but part of the fun of going there was, if we eat all of our food, we get a lollipop with a picture of a sea serpent on it. Won't that be fun?
And it was fun.
It was fun.
Ah, the memories. Kevin, what are your memories?
Well, I called in yesterday with the dumb pencil reference, so today's dumb movie reference is in Blazing Saddles, the original Howard Johnson was in Rock Ridge. It had one flavor.
That's very funny. Because in years late, like later on, and this was before Bresler's or Baskin-Robbins and the huge assortment of flavors, Howard Johnson's led the league because they had like 18 flavors, and that was a ton.
That was the town where everybody was named Johnson, so I just figured I'd throw that out there.
Thank you, Kevin. Very
Thank
funny.
Thank you, Kevin. Dick Johnson should move there.
Yes.
Is this Gary?
Yeah.
Where was your first job, Gary?
Oak Brook.
At the Howard Johnson's in Oak Brook?
At the Howard Johnson's
wow.
in Oak Brook.
What did you do there?
I was a cook.
You weren't the chef that was on the logo, were you?
No.
You know what I'm talking about, though, right?
Yeah, I was 16 years old, and 90% of the stuff that you would have at the restaurant came to us in a plastic bag that you put in boiling water.
Oh, no.
You mean my chicken a la king was not homemade?
No.
Oh, no. That's not good.
It came to us in little bags, and you put them in boiling water. I mean, it wasn't usually word made. You know, they weren't made.
It wasn't homemade. You're ruining it for us, Gary.
Not my fault.
Don't pull back the curtain. Thank you so much. Our own Kim Gordon checking in with a Hojo memory.
Hey, Kim.
Okay, good morning, guys.
Hi.
Okay, so I totally remember the lollipop.
Really?
But do you remember this? When you go to Howard Johnson's and get a kid's meal, underneath every plate was a different picture of, I don't know, like a fairy tale or a nursery rhyme, and it was always a big deal to clean our plate to see what picture we got on our plate. Do you remember
yes.
that?
Yes, yes.
And what a great idea to get kids to finish their meal.
Right.
Remember that.
I ever ate fried clams.
I think they just fried rubber bands, if you want to know the truth. And anything fried is good.
They were still pretty good.
So because you grew up in the South, Kim, so they were prevalent in the South, weren't they? They were all over the place.
No, they weren't that prevalent in the South, but where I remember always going is we used to drive to New Jersey every summer to go visit my family that lived there. And on the New Jersey Turnpike, there were a bunch of Howard Johnsons. But the coolest ones were that there were two across from each other, and you had to, like, walk a tunnel underneath, and you could go from one to the other.
Wow.
That was pretty cool.
This is a sad day. I guess it originated in Boston, so.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And some of them had, like,
all up and down the turnpike.
Remember, there was, like, a branch of them that were, like, a modern-looking, like, they were very angular, you know? It was, like, it was the 60s, the late 60s, but they're like, this is what the year 2000 is going to look like. Yeah.
Kind of A-framey, kind of like.
The one in Skokie for years.
Oh, yeah.
Remember the one in Skokie?
Yes.
It was there for years because it was near my sister's house, and we'd always stay there.
I do
Such
remember.
Such beautiful memories. There's only going to be one left.
And
Kim, the Hojos.
We got to work on a road trip there with Steve Bertrand Travel.
All right. I'm ready.
All right.
Thanks,
we'll put
Kim.
Your name down. Thanks, Kim. All right. Let's take a quick break. The rest of the show will be far happier. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Ryan, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. And we'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. If you want to call in or text in, please do. There has been a very interesting fold in the Roger Ailes case. Roger Ailes, for those of you who do not know, was the Fox News CEO. He's the guy. He really, if you look at the guy who blueprinted Fox News to be different from all the other news services, it was Roger Ailes who said, for years and years and years, the news has been given without a particular slant, and what we're going to do is we're going to give it a slant. We're going to go kind of extreme to the right, and when you hear Fox News, you're going to hear it from our angle, from our viewpoint, and that's from the extreme right. A side note, I've told you this. I worked for him for a summer years and years and years ago. I never met him, but I met people who knew him very well. And the range of emotions when it came to Roger Ailes, I can't think of anybody in my career. There were some people I talked to who loved him and called him a visionary and said, this is the smartest guy I've ever dealt with. There were other people that when you said his name, you could see them get physically ill, you know?
He was a visionary.
He really was.
Like it or don't, it was a great idea.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the problem with Roger Ailes' story is, like, from everything we've told you, you'd go, well, that's good for him then. He came up with a new way to do the news. The problem is that several people, including Gretchen Carlson over at Fox News, Andrea Tenteros over at Fox News, and others, have in the last several months accused him of sexual harassment or harassment, depending on how you want to pronounce it.
Either way, it's bad.
And this is one of those stories that makes you a little bit crazy because of these stories, he has had to step down from his role over at Fox News, but he gets a huge settlement. He'll make more money as part of this settlement to step down than almost all of us together will make in our lifetimes.
Wow, that's a dream come true.
But isn't that one of those weird things that sometimes life throws you a curveball where you go, wait a minute, this guy is being accused of sexual harassment with all these women over the years, and because of this, he loses his job, but he gets millions and millions and millions of dollars. How does that happen? But it does.
Well, it was his baby.
Yeah.
And that's why he named it Fox, because he put a lot of nice-looking women on there.
Yeah. That's why they named it Fox. All right, so here's the disturbing fold that has just come in the Roger Ailes story. And I'll tell you what it is, but then I'll tell you what it really is, because the headline of this story isn't quite right. The headline is, former Fox News CEO Roger Ailes reportedly called Stacey Dash the black girl. If you don't know who Stacey Dash is, she's an actress who was in the movie Clueless. And is an outspoken right-winger, and Fox News decided about a little over a year ago, to bring Stacey Dash in as a correspondent. So a lot of times when there's a major story, they'll cut to Stacey Dash, and she'll give you her viewpoint from the black perspective. But Roger Ailes didn't refer to her as Stacey or Stacey Dash. He just called her the black girl, which is disturbing. Learn her name, right? But that's not the problem. Here's the problem. The problem is, and the headline I just read you is one of several headlines, and in every headline about the story that I could find online, it's about how he just didn't bother to learn her name. He just, whenever he would talk about her, he would say the black girl. But now I'll read you more to the story, and I'll tell you where it's really disturbing, and I can't believe the headline doesn't reflect how disturbing this part of it is. Information has been released about the $50 million sexual harassment lawsuit against former Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, and it's not quite shocking to read how Ailes allegedly felt about Stacey Dash and other women of color who worked at the network. According to Andrea Tenteros' lawsuit, and that's one of the lawsuits that's come against Roger Ailes, Ailes routinely called Dash the black girl, as well as calling host Kimberly Guilfoyle a Puerto Rican whore.
Good God.
Tantoros also alleges that Ailes said that Harris Faulkner has a tendency to look like an angry black woman. Now, for me, that's just as big a part of the story, calling one of the people who you employ a Puerto Rican whore. That's just as bad, if not worse, than not learning Stacey Dash's name and only calling her the black girl. That's bad, but I think hiring somebody and referring to them to coworkers as a Puerto Rican whore, I think is worse, don't you?
I think the whole thing is
terrible. The whole thing is bad.
And, you know, I know, was it Gretchen Carlson who said she kind of put up with this because she wanted to keep her job and everything? That bothers me in a way, too. I know you're making a lot of money,
right,
but when you're in an environment like that,
right,
you got to walk.
See, the debate about that is this. People have said, find another job. But I think she's the victim here. She shouldn't have to be the one. I'm sure you've seen the videotape of her with her two co-stars for Fox and Friends, where they kind of attack her from both ends, usually in a sexual manner. And I didn't watch the show with any regularity. I saw it every once in a while, and I'd see a clip every here and there. But I didn't know that it was anywhere near as frequent. There's a clip that runs on YouTube that you can watch like 4 or 5 minutes of different days of them just
being really sexist.
Being really sexist towards it.
I have never watched Fox in my life. My in-laws had to get a new TV because the Fox logo was burnt into the TV.
Really?
Yes. Yikes. And I have never watched it. I am not a Politico. I am certainly not far right wing. And to me, it's just watching angry TV. But you're right. They're the victim and they shouldn't have to leave. But at some point you have to stand up for yourself and say, I know I'm making a lot of money, but like if you humiliated me every day, which you do, but not based on my sex.
Right. For other reasons.
Yes. You couldn't put up with that. At some point you have to be true to yourself and go, you know, I am making a lot of money, but really this isn't right.
You know, so many people said, oh, when she was working there, it was fine. But as soon as they let her go, all of a sudden, all the allegations came out. But I don't buy that.
No, it wasn't fine if you see those clips.
Right.
It was not fine.
No, not at all. But then if you're her, you say to yourself, like, while I was working there, I'm trying to think of how I would have handled it tactfully. I guess the one way to do it is to say to your boss, in this case, Roger Ailes or whoever, hey, I know you guys think it's fun, but it's not fun for me. There must be some other way to handle our on-air and off-air relationship other than what's going on now. That seems equitable, doesn't it?
Yeah, but they would have said, there's the door.
Yeah, I guess. But then don't you just talk to an attorney and maybe chronicle all the different times that's happening and say,
yep,
look, this is happening way too, like one time is too often, but this is happening with so much regularity. This is a hostile work environment. We have to do something about it.
And they did. He's getting sued by how many people?
He's getting sued by a bunch of people. Yeah, it was what, much like the Bill Cosby case where it seemed like everybody was just kind of hanging back. All of a sudden, once people realized I'm not the only one going through this.
The floodgates were opened.
Yeah, yeah.
What a scumbag.
Without a doubt. In her lawsuit, Andrea Tanteros blames Roger Ailes and show host Bill O'Reilly for making the workplace uncomfortable. Ailes resigned last month and declined a $40 million severance package. Now, you hear that and you go, well, because he knows he's guilty. No, it's because he's looking for more money. He doesn't think $40 million is enough to cover it. He wants more money for sexually harassing people who worked for him.
Yeah.
Tanteros' lawsuit states Fox News masquerades as a defender of traditional family values, but behind the scenes, it operates like a sex-fueled Playboy Mansion-like cult.
Jeez.
Steeped in intimidation, indecency, and misogyny. There's no word.
Sign me up.
You want in? There's no word yet about how Stacey Dash feels about being referred to as, quote-unquote, the black girl. But something tells me that she's probably okay with this. That's the opinion of a website called The Root. But I'm telling you, I saw this headline in several places, all focusing on the fact that Stacey Dash is called the black girl, which is wrong. But if I'm Kimberly Guilfoyle, I would think the term Puerto Rican whore, when your boss is calling you that with other coworkers, is just as damaging. That's terrible.
That is terrible. I can't even imagine this. I really can't.
It's awful. It's just beyond awful. All right, a quick break, and then
what
more
a
show.
Country.
What a country. 312, thank you, Belky.
You're welcome.
312-981-7200, if you'd like to jump in. That's our text line and our phone line. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. We're talking a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes at Fox News. Roger Ailes, former CEO of Fox News, stepped down about a month ago because of allegations alleging that he sexually harassed several workers. The latest development is that word has just come out that he was referring to some of his workers, some of the people who were employed by him, Stacey Dash notably, as the black girl, Kimberly Guilfoyle as the Puerto Rican whore, and said of Harris Faulkner has a tendency to look like an angry black woman.
The Puerto Rican whore thing, it's like, oh, yeah, that's what she looked like, but I still hired her.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
Yeah.
In so many ways. Allison's on the line. She called us at 312-981-7200. Hi, Allison.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I agree with you guys on everything you said about what Roger Ailes says about those women. Positively disgusting.
Awful.
Awful. But you guys were talking about Gretchen Carlson and how people were saying, you know, she should have just left her job, you know, no matter how much money she was making.
I don't think she should have just left.
No, well, sometimes you can't. And I, when I was in my 20s, my boss propositioned me, asked me to come home with him and sleep with him. Mm. And I laughed in his face and said that would never, ever happen. And that was on a Friday night. And on Monday morning, I come into work and there's a letter that I was CC'd on that he recommend my immediate termination.
Oh my God.
I mean, it was such a blatant form of harassment. And I called my father, who called a lawyer, and I had to work at my job and go in every single day for the next 8 months until the lawyers could hash stuff out. I mean, I had to be the best employee possible. So it could be that Gretchen Carlson had contacted her lawyer and her lawyer said to her, listen, until we get all of our ducks in a row and we talk to the Fox lawyers, you have to go to work. You cannot give them any reason to fire you. You have to be the perfect employee so that we have all this ammunition against them.
How did this play out, Allison? What was the end result with your story?
Well, I had to leave.
You did have to leave.
I did have to leave. And
he's still the boss.
He got promoted.
Of course. Failing up.
Yep. Yeah.
And someone texted that, too, that perhaps, you know, she didn't leave because she was getting a case together. And I guess that's it. But I don't know. It's just at some point you have to say enough is enough.
Mm. You do. It's so hard. I mean, he was vile to me those 8 months. I mean, I would go home every day and cry because it was so bad going into work and I could not do anything. I was basically tied to my job. I could not leave and I could not talk about it. And no one stood up for me. And even though everyone knew what was going on, it was horrible. And I have no doubt that Gretchen Carlson and actually any woman who has to go through this has to deal with the same stuff.
It's so terrible.
Sorry you went through this, Allison, but it made you a stronger person. How many millions of people told you that?
That's right. It did. You know, it shaped the person I became. And you know what? I don't stand for any of that nonsense. And
good.
If there's anyone that I can help, hey, by all means, I'll tell my story.
That's very good.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too.
Just really quickly, we got a bunch of texts on this, and there's one of them that says, why are you going out of your way to mention that Fox is a slant to the right? And they are. I think they would tell you, even though their catchphrase is fair and balanced, that they do slant to the right. But somebody said you wouldn't tell the story if it was on the left. But the fact that Fox News is to the right is sort of pertinent to the story of how he crafted a different kind of news, you know? Up until Fox News, if you were watching the news, you kind of got it from the middle.
Right.
Nobody was doing it from the left or from the right. But it's pertinent to the story that they decided to go to the right.
And a visionary, that he was.
I will give him that.
Not so much.
Yeah, isn't that something? All right, a quick break. Ryan with the news, and then Dr. John Duffy joins us. Stay where you are. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
It's Bill F. It's Wendy Snyder. And thank you, Ryan Burrow. Wednesdays, every other Wednesday, Dr. John Duffy comes in. He's a clinical psychologist, a great author. The book is called The Available Parent. And I am intrigued by your podcast, which you can find at WGNplus.com and also on your website, drjohnduffy.com.
Correct.
Hello, sir.
Hello. Thanks for having me, guys.
John, always a pleasure to have you. We have a very specific topic about kids going back to school. But before we get into that, there was a major story over the last week or so. Wendy and I discussed it several times. And I just want to get your take on it. That's the Ryan Lochte story where he made up an alleged incident.
He embellished.
He embellished.
I heard a little bit about
some
this.
Some might say he lied.
Right.
All right. My question is this, and Wendy and I discussed this at great lengths the other day, but without you here, I think that this is what the professionals like to call a teachable moment about how a lie can snowball, and in this particular instance, cost this guy millions and millions of dollars in endorsements just because he decided he thought he could get away with a lie. What do you think?
I agree entirely. You know, there are a lot of people who might take a different tack on that and make fun of him, which a lot of people are doing. It's happening in a lot of households. It's happening in a lot of media.
We did that too, by the way.
We did too.
Yeah.
But I think more importantly, it is a teachable moment. You know, a lot of kids think that there is very little repercussions to a white lie, a little white lie. But in fact, this is a really telling story. The repercussions of what he did were enormous and something that he probably didn't predict at all at the time. And so, you know, like I worked with a girl this week who had told her mother a little white lie about where she was going to be later that evening. And this snowballed into a disaster for the family. So, you know, we actually talked about, you know, you're Ryan Lochte this week, you know,
and so
you have the opportunity to repair that. But avoiding the opportunity for the teachable moment is a mistake. I think you want to take opportunities as often as they come. And this one couldn't be more glaring.
Sure.
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong to saying to your child, hey, we all, to some extent, will embellish the truth from time to time and even lie from time to time. But in this particular instance, this shows you clear cut that this guy's career is now tarnished forever because of this.
Right. Because of this one moment. And if he were just impeccable with the truth, even if it were mortifying, he might have a way more opportunity on his hands. Right.
Yep, that makes sense.
I had a similar moment. My son Michael started his senior year, and last week, both boys were looking through one of the junk drawers and found their baby books. And Michael said, I found my baby book, and I kind of got really sad. And I said, what about Dylan? He goes, Dylan's book was empty because he's the second kid.
Yeah.
And I said, was Dylan sad about that? He goes, no, not really, but I'm sad. And then you texted me about my college essays, and I'm not ready to be an adult.
Yeah.
That's what he said to me. And I said, you know what? Being an adult can be fun, but when you make a mistake, there are more serious consequences. It's not life or death,
right?
But there are going to be bigger consequences now that you're an adult. One really wants to get there, but it's fun.
It's
just more pressure.
There's all these positives. You know, it's so funny you bring that up, Wendy. I'm hearing that more and more from kids in the last few years, this resistance to being an adult. And I think a lot of it has to do with, like, boy, everything I do has so much more weight to it, you know? Forgetting that there's all this liberty, there's all this freedom that comes along with being an adult. This is the good stuff. And I think as parents, it's probably incumbent upon us to remind them, you know, like, hey, there's a lot of really great things about being an adult too, but is there responsibility? Absolutely. Are you being held to a different standard of truth and you know, just accountability? For sure.
Ryan Lochte. That's what I'm saying.
Yep.
The consequences are bigger now.
Yep.
With
no
great power comes great responsibility. You know who said that? Spider-Man.
Is that right?
Yep. Spider-Man
said
that, and
he
was right.
He said a lot of pithy, great quotes.
Yes.
Although we were talking about Howard Johnson's and the lack thereof earlier, and it does bring you back to a time when you were a kid where decisions aren't so serious.
Sure.
It is tough to grow up, but I feel like our generation, I couldn't wait to get my license. I couldn't wait to be 21 so I could drink legally. I couldn't wait for all these things. And I'm seeing these kids are more resistant to it.
They are. I think we had the luxury of being a little more naive. We didn't have so much media in our face.
Yeah.
We didn't know what the risks were, so we were willing to take them, you know? And by and large, things worked out. Kids now are a little more cautious, and they realize, oh boy, everything I say is a little more public. There's a little more in the way of repercussions. There's social media out there.
Right.
I can be captured at any moment, and it can be just spread to anybody, anywhere. And we just didn't have that risk.
So there's good to that, and there's bad to that.
Absolutely.
Isn't there?
As with anything,
yeah,
really.
I guess so.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and the good for kids is that they can stay in so much contact with one another, and you know, and that's really great, especially for kids who are a little more shy. The bad is that the risks run pretty high, especially socially.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They would have to.
Yeah.
Dr. John Duffy is here. DrJohnDuffy.com is his website. We're going to talk about back to school and how that affects your kids and you next. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Dr. John Duffy in the studio, a clinical psychologist, author of a wonderful book called The Available Parent, and does some podcasts, which you can find at WGNplus.com and also on his website, DrJohnDuffy.com. I have to tell you, pretty excited for both kids to be back at school because you need to get a routine going again.
Absolutely. I most kids I know are ready.
Bill blasted me on this yesterday.
I hear that all the time, and I can only speak for myself, but when I was a kid, I was never ready to go back to school. I love school, but if summer vacation magically became another 3 months, I'd be fine with that.
You know, I think I would have felt that way as a kid, too. Kids today, maybe it's because there's a lot of screens involved, and you know they're just not out of the house for 12 hours or something like that.
Maybe.
I think they just get a little bored and restless, and they're ready to go back. All
right. And young, I got to be honest with you, my kids, whole social life involves school.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have a ton of friends that they hang with on a regular basis. They have a few, but getting back to school, it's the whole social atmosphere again.
I think it's just being around peers and a lot of them every single day that kind of centers them in a way that they are not centered in the middle of August.
Right.
Yeah.
To some extent, even though a lot of us say that we're against structure,
right,
when it comes right down to it, we kind of enjoy the structure.
We need some of it,
yeah,
right? I mean, you know, it kind of anchors us. So if we want to do something a little further afield, we at least have the structure to hold us, you know, centered so we don't feel kind of unglued.
Yeah, and, I can see that.
Yeah, it's really important for
sure.
Kids. Yeah.
So are there certain guidelines? Are there certain things we should do to get our house ready for back to school?
Definitely. Here's a couple ideas. And I always encourage parents and families to take advantage of transitions, right? So this is a natural transition. Almost every family in America with kids is going through it right now. So I encourage parents to kind of start setting regular bedtimes, regular wake-up times, homework times. Like, let's protect a certain amount of time and the whole house will be quiet for that hour and a half when everybody's doing homework, you know, to kind of really set some new rules and to be clear as parents about what my role is, what our role is. So we're not going to be the ones who call the teachers or call the school if you're running late. You're going to handle more and more and more of the tasks with the idea in mind that our goal as parents is competence and resilience.
Yeah.
So if you're in a habit of kind of doing a lot for your kid. Okay, I'll call the coach because it seems like he's not being very nice to you, or I'll see if I can handle this bullying situation. The more you let your kid do, starting now, this school year, the more competent and resilient they'll come out. And that's more important to me than grades or, you know, anything that lands on a transcript, because that'll set them up for success going forward.
I went to a college application night last night. They do it for the parents today, and then Thursday the kids do it at their high school, getting ready for college, all this stuff. And the first thing the woman said that was talking was, I know you want to help your kids do the applications, and that's okay to help them, but definitely let them do it. She said, there have been very many times I will bring something up to a student, like, well, what it says here on your application, and he goes, I couldn't even tell you, my mom did it.
Absolutely. Happens all the time. And this happens not just with college applications, but with English papers, with math homework, you know. Oh, it's getting late, I'll go ahead and do that for you. And the less of that you do, and it's hard to convince parents because they want their kids to feel successful. But kids are smart. They know, like, if they aced that math class, but mom or dad did the homework, they know that's not their A. They know that somebody else earned that for them. So let them feel the consequence when things don't go well. And when they do, you know, that the other flip side is oftentimes things go well and they get to feel like the success of earning that.
Don't you kind of have to find some sort of happy medium, though? Both my wife and I have helped our daughters with their homework. So at some point you have to figure out what the difference is between helping and just straight out doing it for them, you know?
Great point. Yeah, I think, you know, if we kind of depict ourselves as consultants instead of doers, it's like, okay, well, what's your idea? What do you think? And then kind of draw it out of them. And if you help them a little bit, I think that's fine, as long as you know, like, you're establishing some degree of competence in them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You don't know how many nights I have spent going, do your homework. Yeah, I'll get to it. Do your homework. I must say it 20 times a night. There came a point last year where I said, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. They know what they have to do. They can sink or swim on their own. And Michael had his best year.
Right.
And Dylan surprised me and did his homework as well.
Right.
It's like, you know, and Jim and I would sit there and commiserate and said, it was so like our parents. We'd be like, we went to school. We did our homework. We don't need to help you. But at some point, you do have to just go, you know what? If you're going to get a D, that's your business. You got to get it up to a B on your own.
And this is the time to get the D and to feel that pinch so you realize, okay, I don't want to feel that again. So next semester, I'm going to be on it. I'm going to set a time. I'm going to do that homework. I'm going to consult mom and dad as I need them.
Yeah. How do you determine, John? I know for some kids, when I was growing up, my best friend, for instance, as soon as he got home from school, that was homework time, and he couldn't go out and play until his homework was done.
Right.
At our house, it was the last thing we did before we went to bed,
yep.
You know?
Yeah.
So how do you determine what is the best way and time?
Different things seem to work for different families. I favor earlier the better, you know, because I think once you – because there's so many distractions in houses
sure.
now. Once you start looking online, once you're on, you know, Instagram – the idea of getting to homework becomes so unappealing to kids
yeah.
that it's just going to get put off and put off and put off. So I love an after school activity of some kind. But as soon as that's over, and maybe as soon as dinner's eaten, my bias is to get to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think the longer you put it off, the more openings you have for excuses not to do it.
I would imagine you're going to suggest that the TV be turned off during homework and maybe the radio as well.
You know me well, Bill.
Yeah. I know. We always had the TV on when I was doing homework. And in retrospect, like when I told my wife that when I was a kid, we had the TV on, we'd watch TV during homework. She'd go, how did you graduate? How'd you get through classes that way? But it worked for me.
My son, Michael, listens to music while he does homework all the time.
The music thing is kind of interesting because I do find that some kids really can function really well listening to music. And to my surprise, even music with lyrics, like, you know, like some kids early on, you know, years ago when they had their first iPods were telling me, oh, I can listen to music without lyrics.
Oh.
Now kids are telling me, like, I can listen to rap music and focus. And
wow.
I believe them. You know, they function really well. So
yeah.
My bias is if they're really talking about a tool that helps them cope through homework, I wouldn't take that away necessarily.
Yeah.
Even if it feels like, boy, we never did that. We never needed that.
Yeah.
Some people use it in the workplace now.
What happens if a teacher sends a note back saying, hey, I've had your kid in class for a little while. He's not handing in. She's not handing in her homework assignments. What's the easiest way to explain to them that that's a part of school that you need to work harder on?
Yeah. I think you want to sit your child down and tell them, okay, I heard from your teacher. This is what I heard. This is not my job. This is your job. But if you need any help, let me know and I'll help facilitate that. But this is really mostly on you. I'll consult and I'll guide and I'll be your ally in this. But this is your job, not my job.
Right.
And kids often... just so you guys keep this in mind, they rise to this occasion. You
do
know,
they
yeah, they tend to. You know, more so than I'm going to do this for you because I don't know if you're capable of it.
Right.
You know, because they'll sense that show of no confidence.
Sure.
It's real apparent.
Sure.
And I saw this out of Fort Worth, Texas. Teacher's note to parents is going viral after it was introduced. A student-friendly approach to homework. In a nutshell, it was a letter that went home saying, dear parents, after much research this summer, I'm trying something new. Homework will only consist of work that your student didn't finish during the school day. There will be no formally assigned homework this year. That's not a bad idea.
You know, I love that idea. You know, there's some really good research. I hope there aren't too many kids listening because there's a lot of homework being assigned. But there's some really good research that suggests that more than about 10 minutes of homework per subject a night, just review, is not that useful.
Really,
really doesn't help them retain a whole lot and is just busy work. That
we
keeps
have this
them
on
busy
tape,
throughout.
Kevin. Is this on tape? Yeah. All right, good.
You either know it or you don't in some points.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. But the kids who are doing, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours of homework, you know, there's so little balance in their lives
yeah.
that often they'll get to college and things will go haywire for
yeah.
them. So I so far prefer balance. So I tend to agree with this teacher.
He's Dr. John Duffy, and you can listen to his podcast, WGNRadio.com. If people want to get in touch with you, questions, or perhaps book an appointment, how do they reach you?
You can reach me at, you can email me at johngduffy@drjohnduffy.com or follow me on Facebook at Dr. John Duffy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, it's Bill, it's Wendy, and we've got more stuff coming up. Bill, I got to be honest with you. Every time I think lobster, I think of you. I know there was a lobster boy who had a claw-like hand, but I'm going to start calling you Lobster Boy.
I would accept that title. I would love that title.
You just came back from Maine,
yeah,
and you're bragging to everybody that out of your meals, how many were lobster-related?
We were in Maine for 5 days. I don't eat breakfast, but I had lunch and dinner each day, so that's 10 meals over my time there, and 9 out of 10, I had lobster, either a lobster roll for lunch or a different sort of lobster for dinner.
What happened on that 10th?
Just went for a hamburger, just to mix it up a little bit.
All right, well, something you should be very interested in. There's the Great American Lobster Fest that is happening on Labor Day weekend at Navy Pier, and you should go. You should be the king of the...
I want to go so badly. This sounds like heaven to me.
Jeffrey Mazza in the studio, president of the New England Seafood Company and a member of the Great American Lobster Fest. Hi, Jeffrey.
How you doing? Thanks for having us.
And Nick Pabutsky.
You said that great.
Did I? Nick Pabutsky is a member of the fest as well. We're going to find out what's going on. This is the third year that Navy Pier is hosting the legendary Lobster and Seafood Festival. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It's the Midwest's largest.
Yes, it is.
How much lobster are you going to be cooking that weekend?
We will have right now about 4,000 lobsters coming in from Boston, and we'll have tons of food, tons of lobster meat, tons of all seafood, shrimp and calamari and all sorts of stuff.
Shrimp cocktail.
I'm leaving right after the show to be first in line. I want to be the first person in line for this. This sounds just ideal to me. How did this all start?
Yeah, so one of our partners is a couple different companies involved, and we kind of all joined together to kind of put this event in place. It was kind of a unique fest that you really don't see too often out here in the Midwest.
Yeah, because we don't get lobster out here. We can, but we need to celebrate it more. That's what we felt.
Well, we felt the same way too. So, you know, we all kind of chatted, and Navy Pier got a little wind of it, and they thought it'd be a good spot for them too. And it's a perfect spot for something like this. And it's year three, and trying to keep going and make improvements. And
we really create like a Maine atmosphere at the far east end of Navy Pier, and it's just amazing. And it's grown every year from 2014, and was our debut year, and now we're celebrating the third, and we're really excited to have it on Labor Day weekend.
Explain why that region of the United States, so if you start at Massachusetts and you go up into New Hampshire and then Maine, that's the ideal lobster area right there. And why would that be? What is it about those waters that make the lobster so good?
Well, it's a big fishing ground, too, so there's a lot of, food, for a lot of this stuff to happen. And even in the Canadian Maritime up there, they're all migrating from that whole region. It's huge. And then... summertime, they all kind of come on shore a little bit, and they molt as well, their shells. They kind of get a little softer shells during that time of year. But usually it's deep waters, and it's prime fishing ground out there.
Can you tell me how something so hideous tastes so wonderful?
Wendy, lobsters are listening. You can't that, please.
They are just really not attractive. But boy, who ate the first lobster? Who said, oh, here's a thing I'm going to try to eat?
That's an interesting question. That was actually a food for prisoners at the time. And they were kind of like at the point saying, don't feed us any more lobsters. But
oh, my God.
They kind of definitely evolved prisoners.
Now. Yeah, that was a food that would wash up on shores. And here's food.
Here, let's give it to them.
Yeah.
At least they're getting something to eat.
Wow.
Yeah, so we all know how that has changed. So
just a little bit. Yeah, very rarely now in a prison will they give them lobster, right?
Yeah, probably. Who knows? There's McDonald's is selling lobster rolls on the East Coast.
I know that. I saw that.
So who knows what they're doing.
Have you had one? Are they decent?
Not from McDonald's, though.
I have.
Is it okay?
It's okay.
It does the trick?
It's okay.
It's a McDonald's lobster roll. Yeah. What else do you expect?
It's not great. I don't like when places will put I'm not a fan of celery to begin with, but a lot of times places will pack it down with celery and filler like that. I don't want that in my lobster roll.
Yeah, and that's luckily for us. We don't like that either. I mean, growing up in Boston, I mean, we have it's very lightly toasted on the bun, which are from Boston, and then very light mayonnaise on the inside and pure lobster with a little bit of seasoning and some butter on top. And we think the lobster is pretty sweet and succulent as it is. So we let that do the talking.
All right. Speaking of lobster being sweet and succulent, which is Bill's nickname.
Sweet and succulent.
I noticed you putting some sauces in various different things. There are a couple of kinds, actually three kinds of lobster rolls that you will be serving at the Great American Lobster Fest. Why don't you talk about those? The traditional.
Yeah, sure. So traditional is always, I think, our staple. This year we wanted to mess around a little bit and come up with a cool new menu option. So we have a Chicago roll, And then also a spicy buffalo roll. And, you know, being from Boston, I would never really kind of go even near that or even touch it. But we were, when we were sampling it and coming up with this, they were pretty good. So, you know,
because I said to you, Jeffrey, you were spraying some sauce on one of them.
You were very nervous. You're like, what are you doing to that lobster?
Well, in Boston, you would have been in, you would have been in prison. They would put you in jail where you could have lobster. We just learned. But I never saw that before. But this is part of the Chicago lobster roll.
Well, we were, you know, like I said, I would never go near that, but it was really good.
Yeah.
Okay, so the buffalo one, and then what is the Chicago one? Is that different than the buffalo sauce?
It is. So the Chicago run has
mustard and pickles.
Pickles, yeah, it's got some peppers on top, with the pickles inside, and it's pretty good.
Nice big ripe tomatoes as well.
Oh, tomatoes and
so you guys have taken elements of like the Chicago hot dog or something like that, and merged it with the lobster roll. Very smart.
Exactly. So those
very
are new items this year.
All right, we have Jeffrey Mazza, president of the New England Seafood Company, 3341 North Lincoln Avenue. Also, he's a member of the Great American Lobster Fest, which is happening at Navy Pier Labor Day weekend. Nick Pabutsky, also a member of the fest, will continue talking lobster. Prisoners, can you even
believe
that?
Prisoners used to enjoy this, yes.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. There's a motion in the ocean. There, you know, thanks to Kevin, he said, are there any other lobster songs? There aren't really.
There's not that many.
You should write one.
I'm going to start writing one because there should be a lot more lobster songs. It's not well represented in the world of music.
No, it sure isn't. Great American Lobster Fest is happening not this weekend, but Labor Day weekend. Jeffrey Mazza, president of the New England Seafood Company, and Nick Pabutsky, member of the fest as well. Now, what's going on? Friday, Saturday, this Great American Lobster Fest is going on at Navy Pier, and then Sunday is something new, right?
Yeah, new for 2016 is the Great American Lobster Cruise. So we will be taking the Spirit of Chicago with about 500 people, and it's a lavish lobster buffet, seafood and non-seafood items, and also music, DJs, dancing, entertainment, and games. So it's about a three-hour sail on Lake Michigan. And we just wanted to give members who have been to the festival for a few years something new to look forward to. So that's the lobster cruise this year.
Boy, that sounds like fun. That really does sound nice.
You can pretend you're not in Chicago for a minute. You're going to pretend you're in Maine, aren't you?
I would pretend I'm in Maine, although I'm leery whenever I hear a three-hour cruise.
Yeah.
I've watched so much Gilligan's Island that I get a little nervous, but I trust you guys.
And Friday night, some great musical entertainment as well.
Oh, we have fantastic artists lined up. Friday is the Dirty Dozen Brass Band.
Oh, they're great.
Coming up all the way from New Orleans.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a nice mix, and we're adding, I guess, a Cajun brass band to the New England atmosphere that we're creating on Navy Pier. And then Saturday is the Liverpool Legends, so a complete Beatles experience. This band is kind of hand selected and curated by Louise Harrison, George Harrison's sister, who will also be present at the festival. So she'll be there to mix and mingle with Beatles fans. And, you know, we just want to provide great music to go along with the great food.
Have you eaten your lobster roll yet?
No, I'm looking at it lovingly because part of the experience of a lobster roll is just kind of cherishing the fact that it's there and it's waiting for me. And, I can't wait. All of these look so good. I can't. This is a big thing, as you know, in New England. A lot of times you go to a lobster pound and they'll have you select the lobster, and I can't do that. That's too hard for me
to pick
the one.
They're laughing at you. I can't either, but they're laughing at you.
I can't do it. I've tried a couple times, but I just always say it's always the same thing. Just pick the one that looks like they want to go. Whichever one seems to want to volunteer, take that one.
What do you do
one.
In that case? Just pick the biggest one? Is there a difference in taste? Like, does the biggest lobster taste as sweet?
I think some would say a little bit tougher, but
really,
I think those are a little bit larger ones and like the 3-4 pounders up. But, if I had to choose, I'd say like a 2-pound lobster would be the best.
2-pound, do you go for an active one? You don't want one that's stuck on the bottom, just kind of saying, please don't pick me. And I'm thinking racehorses, you want somebody who's very active. Is there a certain way to pick a lobster?
No, I would just dive right in and grab one.
The biggest one.
Yeah.
Right.
And where did the lobster roll originate? Because until I met you, honestly, I never
had
one.
You never heard of them?
No, we've had lobster tails and stuff. Again, I'm from the Midwest. I've never been to Maine. And it's just typically lobster on some kind of toasted bread or roll. It's pretty basic, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's in the East Coast style split top bun, we've had a few people think it was like a lobster roll, like a sushi roll.
Oh yeah,
and we're like, no, that's not what we're talking
it's
about.
It's lobster on a roll, basically.
Correct. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
really all it is.
Although you're seeing a lot more restaurants in Chicago are serving up lobster mac and cheese. A couple yep. years ago, you'd really have to search to find that, but now it's becoming a little more standard. And for some reason, I don't know what it is. I guess it's because you can get lobster, you can transport it fairly easily in a day. The lobster I'm getting here in Chicago tastes just as fresh as the lobster I'm getting on the East Coast.
Yeah, and nowadays it is. And you know, we like to think we got some real good connections out east,
yeah.
and you know, to bring it here a lot quicker and stuff. But yeah, you do see a lot now on yeah. the menus.
Somebody just texted and said, I went to Portland, Maine this spring, brought two live lobsters home on the plane. It was the coolest experience ever cooking them at home. All the rumors are is they scream when you put them in the water, but isn't that just some kind of air escaping from the shell?
Yeah.
They're not really screaming, are they?
No,
they love it.
Yeah, they love it.
They want. It's like a sauna to
it's
them.
It's a hot tub.
Right, right. You give them a little towel, you put it around their neck. They enjoy every minute of it. Come on. We tried once, one of our trips to Maine, the guy who lived next door was a lobster fisherman and got us a bunch and just said, just cook them up yourself. It's quite an experience. And it is, but it's just, it's awkward. I want a professional to do it for me.
You don't cook, though. That
no,
is something
we're not
to do
really
with
cooks.
It.
We're not.
Someone else has texted in, why isn't it cheaper in Maine? You mentioned when you were in Maine, the lobster rolls are not cheaper
on average
yet
right
they're
now.
There.
They're $19 to $20 in Maine, and they're—I mean—they catch them 100 yards from where you're eating them. I can get them cheaper here than I can in Maine for some reason.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, that's just—it's all. I mean, it's a little bit supply and demand, but I mean, in the summertime, they got just tourists like crazy coming in there.
And so, you're paying yeah. for a Maine lobster yeah. roll, the image of it, and everything.
That's
too.
So yeah. true, isn't it? You know, when you're there, part of the experience is having a fresh lobster
Correct.
Roll. So they're all even like a couple of years ago when lobsters were at their most plentiful. Would that be about 2 years ago? The prices kept going up in Maine for some weird reason, and they were everywhere you went, you were tripping over lobsters.
Yeah, and I think it was a couple of years ago too that a lot of the domestic fishermen's around there, like
yeah.
It wasn't because it's a commodity, so sometimes the catch is big, sometimes it's small, but a lot of the Canadian guys held the whole market, which drove the prices up big time.
Right,
but it's all supply and demand.
Yeah, when you we were out in a boat in New Hampshire one of the days on this last trip, and you see. I don't know what they're called. They're like where the lobster traps are. There's like a very colorful part that kind of floats above the water.
Oh, like
what
a buoy?
The buoy, yeah. Right. All right. So how do you know if you're a lobster fisherman, if you have a lobster in your trap or not?
You would probably just
you
go back
pull it
and,
up.
And check it out.
You have to physically yeah. pull it up. Because I kept thinking they should invent some sort of like a light at the tip of that to kind of signify something's trapped in there.
Like when the turkey's done, the little thing pops
yeah,
out.
Yeah, they should
like
have
that.
Something like that, but with a more New England-y flavor to it.
That'd be pretty cool.
Like a little thing of butter, like a tub of butter just comes up out of the top or something. I'm still working at it. I'm going to be on Shark Tank soon. You'll see me. <It's funny.
laughs> Always thinking, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, sure.
Are we ever going to run out of lobster?
I don't think so.
Oh, thank you. No. Please say no. Thank you.
Nope. But how come? Everybody is fishing for them. Do they procreate? Do they breed very quickly? Because it's like we go through. How many lobsters are you going to serve up at this Great American Lobster Fest?
A little over 4,000.
There will still be some lobsters left after Lobster Fest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, they got like almost like Olympic-sized pools of all like just filled with lobsters, 18-wheelers coming in every day, millions of pounds that they go through. Just and those are just one or two guys, you know, and think about how many they service throughout the world.
Wendy, when you're out in these waters, like in Maine and New Hampshire, you see thousands and thousands of these lobster traps. They're just all over the water. Yeah, I mean, when you just get to the coast and then the deeper you go, you think, well, at some point these are going to stop. No, miles and miles out into the ocean, there's still all the traps everywhere.
And there are various kinds of lobster. I've had them from, you know, South Africa and stuff. I got to tell you, the tried and true Maine lobster tail is the tastiest
the
one for me.
Well, that's my favorite.
That is the best. Guys, this sound, I don't know who came. I'm going to give credit to both of you. When you came up with this idea, it revolutionized the food business. This is the best thing ever. So come on out. It's the Great American Lobster Fest taking place Friday and Saturday. That's Labor Day weekend. And then the Lobster Cruise is on Sunday. You want to go to AmericanLobsterFest.com. All the information is there. Thank you guys for coming up. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank
absolutely.
You for having us.
Absolutely. We'll take a quick break. We'll find out what's coming up in the Wintrust business launch. That's just a minute or so away. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Thank you, Kim. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. It's the second half of our Wednesday show. Listen in. Enjoy yourselves. We're 312-981-7200.
You consider yourself a good dad, don't you? I know you're a good dad.
I think I am.
You're pretty good.
Thank you.
There's a dad in New Zealand that the whole internet is mad at, and I might agree with the internet on this. A New Zealand hunter has come under fire after submitting photos to a hunting community of his 8-year-old daughter doing something after her first kill.
Yeah.
May I go on?
Sure. Yeah.
Proud dad, daughter, they successfully shot and killed a young stag using his shoulder as a leaning rest last weekend. I have to cough.
All right, go ahead. Because of the story, or you're just not feeling well? Is this story giving you
allergies?
Allergies, yeah. All right.
You're allergic to deer.
I think that might be it.
Do you want to finish the story so I can cough?
I bring Wendy, Kim, from time to time, not every day, but I bring her a little container of venison, and then we test her reaction to it, and it's never pleasant.
I can see the
hives.
I have
a tickle.
Yep. Are you all right?
No, my cough drops are on my desk.
Do you want someone to Heimlich you?
No, I don't. Every time I cough, you say that to Kevin, first of all.
312-981-7200. The 10th caller gets to come in and Heimlich Wendy. 312-591-7200.
She'll be blue by then, but that's okay.
No, it's just allergies. It's like a...
You sure?
Yeah.
All right.
I just saw a thing, ragweed. It's very high
I know.
Right now.
And I woke
up. And what's your outfit made out of?
Ragweed.
Ragweed. That was a terrible mistake.
Hang on, I got to get my Ricola.
I have a lozenge. You got to sing the song. You can't just have a Ricola. You have to sing it or it's not effective. Read the back of the bag. If you don't sing Ricola, it won't work. No, you can't chew it loudly. You got to sing it.
I'm not chewing it. Can't chew these things.
Oh,
I really
man.
Can't continue reading.
All right. You want me to read it?
You got to get the readers, cheaters. I'll tell you this in a nutshell.
Yeah.
This little girl went hunting with her dad.
Yeah.
Shot a deer.
How old is she, by the way? 8, did you say?
Yeah.
She's 8. All right.
There's pictures of her.
You can say it. It's disgusting,
it's
but you can
totally
say it.
It's totally disgusting. She is eating the quivering heart of the deer.
Right. I don't understand that. Now, I'm not a hunter, so I'm probably not the best person to ask about this.
I'm not either.
But even if I were a hunter, and if you were a hunter, I think I would stop short of eating the heart out of the animal that I killed. Don't you?
She wasn't really eating it, but it was, I don't know if it was a photo op or what.
Nibbling on it.
You saw the picture. It's absolutely disgusting.
It's sick.
And now this dad, people are mad at him, and I can see why.
And they're mad at him because, I guess, what sort of a message does this send out to a kid to say, don't just kill the animal, but then remove its heart and take a bite out of it.
She has blood all over her face. It's so disgusting.
Yeah. So what would the good part, I'm sorry I don't know the answer to this, but I don't. What would the positive of this be? Like, if you were
None.
A dad, I understand that hunting is a tradition for many people. So for a father to take his child out and teach them to hunt, I guess I understand that part of the tradition. But what are you saying by eating the animal's heart?
He said, Chloe took a bite from its warm, quivering heart and then has a photo to prove it. And he submitted this to the New Zealand Women Hunters page.
Yeah.
And even the woman hunters are saying, quote, Johnny's parenting is sadistic and psychopathic.
I'd have
to agree.
It's not normal. I'm trying to think if it falls short of sadistic and psychopathic. But I can't even imagine a scenario where I would teach my daughters like anything and I'd go, and if you really want to put a cherry on top of this.
Not a cherry.
Eat right. A superior vena cava.
Yes.
If you really want to put a superior vena cava on top of this, take a bite out of that animal's heart.
Now, many have come to Johnny's defense, the dad, saying that biting the heart of your first kill is an old hunting ritual.
I've heard of that.
I have never heard of that. And if anybody's heard of that or has done it, 312-981-7200.
I have heard of it, but it seems like something from centuries ago. It doesn't seem like a modern day thing.
Have you heard about it in real life or in movies?
In real life.
Paula?
Yeah.
You've heard about this?
Well, not necessarily in real life, but in Dances with Wolves, Kevin Costner was given the heart of a buffalo that he killed.
He didn't eat it, though,
Native
didn't
Americans.
He? Didn't he just
Yeah, they made him take a bite out of it. Yeah.
I'd rather be McGruff the crime dog and take a bite out of crime instead of taking a bite out of a beating heart.
Better option.
I'd rather have a deep dish pizza, actually.
Does it seem, Wendy just described it as being, what were the exact?
Oh, sadistic and psychopathic.
Yeah, is it that, do you think?
You know, I don't think so. If you would talk to hunters, and I'm not a hunter.
Let's get Ted Nugent on the phone.
Zoo, but if you're a hunter, I think the perspective is, different. And it could almost be a sign of respect for the animal. If there's just a different perspective they have, and I don't share it. So
it seems symbolic, as if to say, yeah. I'm the bet of the two of us. I'm the victor, doesn't it? Kind of.
Oh, well, it can be, but I think again, if you flip it around, it could be, respect for the animal.
Hmm.
I don't know. Here's the caption.
In some way, but you'd have to talk to a hunter to get that perspective. Right. Not me.
We should get Alan Hunter on from MTV.
From MTV, one of the first VJs.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much, Paula. We appreciate it. Here's the little caption he put when he posted the picture. And I quote, "Check out my little pink ninja princess Chloe, 8, with her first deer, a young stag, shot in a bush block on a friend's farm last weekend."
Yeah.
He said Chloe took a bite from its warm, quivering heart and has a photo to prove it.
See, how do you even just casually throw that into the story? Like, I would have nightmares about that forever if I was the kid or the adult, right?
Well, the dad's obviously done it before.
Yeah.
Because why would he have his 8-year-old daughter do it if, honey, this is what we do.
I'm sure that it was, like I said, a tradition that probably when his dad took him out for the first time, that's something that happened, but, ugh.
I know. Jerry, are you a hunter?
Yes, I am.
It is
a true tradition, but the real tradition is the Jägermeister that has the deer on the label, and mm-hmm. you can have the shot glasses that are shaped like a deer head.
Oh.
You take a shot, pray to the deer lords, thank you for your kill and everything else, kind of like Ted Nugent does, and then you do your shot of Jäger and just keep going on with Jäger.
So when people say "Dear Lord," it's D-E-E-R. It's not D-E-A-R.
The D-E-E-R.
It
just
is.
Thank you for everything that went on and the good hunt and being out in the field and enjoying nature and the whole nine yards.
All right. Well, I guess it is a ritual, but you've never done it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You have.
We do a lot of strange things out there.
You do the
kiss the first fish when you catch it too. It's a ritual.
I kiss fish.
There you go.
No, I don't. Really? You kiss the fish?
You kiss the fish first one of the season. Just like, thank you for letting me have the first fish and move on and then fill your basket.
Jerry, I'll fill you in on something. A woman's more exciting to kiss.
Okay.
Doesn't sound like you convinced him.
Thank you. We appreciate it, Jerry.
Can I tell you a tradition that I witnessed on a fishing trip once that I found extremely disturbing? One of the guys, it's my dad, and he took me out on a trip on Lake Michigan. And it was guys that he didn't work directly with, but like sales reps from a company. So he knew them, but not really well. So we go out to fish and they're readying all the lines and stuff. And I'm not a fisherman, but here's what he did. He relieves himself in the bucket. And
what
it's
bucket?
The bucket, the bucket that when you catch a fish, you're going to put that fish in the bucket. It kind of hangs out over the side of the boat and you'll keep those fish in that bucket. So he relieves himself in that bucket.
Not your dad.
Not my dad, no, but this other guy that was on the fishing trip. So then I say to my dad, what's he doing? And my dad goes, I'm not sure. Why don't you ask him? So I did.
I love how he says, you ask him, Billy.
Right. This one's on you. So he says that's good luck, that when you go out on a fishing expedition, that brings you good luck. But it didn't bring me good luck. It made me not eat fish for a long time. Because I thought, well, if this guy's doing that, what other fishermen are doing that?
Do you think the Gortons of Gloucester fishermen are doing that?
I hope not.
They do have a yellow jacket.
I never thought of that. I hope you're wrong. I hope. All right, a break, and then back onto this. What are your thoughts about this hunter in New Zealand who had his daughter, after killing a deer, eat its heart? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Because of the guy who kissed the fish? Barracuda.
Barracuda, Wendy.
Bye.
Hearts.
Kevin is the most subliminal producer working today.
We were talking about a New Zealand hunter who's come under fire with a hunting community after he posted something on the website of that hunting community of his 8-year-old daughter eating the heart of her first kill.
So even other hunters are saying this is a little bit much.
A little bit much.
Yeah.
Someone says, they've texted to us, 708, it's not normal to you. People eat everything or almost every part of the animal. Damn, why do you even care?
Well, because you see this adorable little 8-year-old girl just kind of covered in blood and guts, and she looks like it's an episode of Walking Dead.
It really does.
Yeah.
And it's out there. If this dad didn't post the picture, I wouldn't be talking about it.
Right.
Someone else says, I'm an avid hunter, and we don't do that. We just hang their junk from a tree.
Oh, all right.
That's a sad, disrespectful thing to do.
Right.
Grant is a hunter. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Phil and Wendy, longtime hunter, first time caller.
Thank you.
Is this a ritual?
Here in America, what we do with the young hunters is we like to tease the kids that they maybe have to drink the blood of the animal. But what we end up doing is just putting a little smear on their cheek, just to show mama when you get home or the aunts and uncles or whatever that they got their first deer.
Yeah.
And, you're always worked up that first shot, or first deer that you get, oh my God, I gotta, drink the blood. But then we just kind of tease you, and it's fun. It's a fun tradition.
I could see smearing the blood on their cheek just because if they're there hunting, they know that they're killing an animal. So what's the difference?
Right. And we like to promote hunting with the youth. So we don't want to do anything like that to, you have a little teasing, but we don't want to really scare them off, from hunting or anything like that.
And do you eat the deer that you catch?
Yes, I do. Yes, I have not bought beef from the grocery store in probably 20 years.
Look at that.
It's all food you've hunted. That's what you're grilling up?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Everything I eat is usually, I'll eat a cheeseburger from, a fast food restaurant or what have you when I'm out. But when I'm at home, it's kill it and grill it.
Hey, you have an apron that says that, I bet, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Well, you know what the tradition is if you miss the deer that you're shooting at?
What happens then?
Then you take the person's hunting hat and you put it on the backrest of the gun range, and all the other guys get to take a shot at the hat, and then you make them wear the hat for the rest of the week, and it's kind of a reminder that they better not miss on the next shot.
I guess.
Why am I not a hunter? This
You'd be a great hunter.
Well, I got a tree stand with your name on it, Wendy.
All right, keep it up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I don't care if people hunt and they eat their food. I don't care. I just thought this was a little weird that a father's having his 8-year-old daughter. And it's not that it's a daughter, even if it wasn't his 8-year-old son.
Yeah,
chomping on the quivering heart of a deer she just killed.
Right.
Bob,
well, the fact that was her first time, too, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
it was.
You just think that might be traumatic and then to do that.
No, she was ready to go.
She was ready to roll.
She seemed into it.
And celebrating her first kill, I guess, if you're a hunter. Bob, you've been a hunter for how long?
Over 60 years, and I'm 68 years old.
You started that young.
I'll tell you up front that you don't catch deer. You kill them and then you eat them.
Oh, yeah.
But you don't eat their heart, do you?
Oh, no, that's all BS. People put out there, trying to get somebody to make a reaction to it, is all.
But, Bob, you've heard of this before, right? This isn't the first you've heard of somebody doing this, is it?
I've heard that, and I don't agree with it. There's nobody I've ever hunted with ever smears blood on their face or shoots at their cap if they miss or anything like that. You get a lot of ribbing if you miss.
Right.
But other than that, it's a tradition is what it is. And I grew up in Missouri, and you hunted for your food.
Yep.
Squirrels, rabbits, you
yep.
cook. You learn to live with it. And now I'm limited to hunting deer only.
Yeah.
And occasionally fishing out on the lake or wherever.
Sure.
But again,
sure.
I still don't eat their hearts, and I still don't kiss the fish,
Well, to each his own, or her own.
Bob, when I beat someone at tennis, I rub their Gatorade on my face, just as a way of saying I beat you.
I'd prefer some liqueur of some sort.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But all it is marketability, you know. And you, if you watch any of these Alaskan shows, you know, they'll show them. They'll eat a part of a live deer or a live seal or whatever they kill, you know. And it's you know, and they say, well, thank you, Lord, dear Lord, DEA Lord,
right,
for providing this animal for us to partake.
You know, there's nothing wrong with hunting, and especially, Bob, you've been doing it for a long time. It gives you pleasure. You eat the meat that you get. I guess what bothers me is it's so barbaric that it's, you know, raw. I mean, can't you pray and thank the dear Lord after a cooked venison steak?
Yeah, I have somebody that does that. I've never done that, and I've never seen anybody do it. And I've hunted, you know, in many states around the upper Midwest.
Yeah.
And a lot of different groups. And I've never seen anybody do that. So I think it's put out there to get people
riled
going
up a
is
little.
All it is, you know.
Maybe.
And then, too, you know, it's like people, well, I wouldn't eat anything that was killed. Well, don't go to the store and buy a steak that was killed, you know.
That's a good point, although if I had to kill it, I'd become a vegetarian.
Well, that's it. There's a lot of vegans out there that really enjoy, you know, not eating meat. And part of it is because, well, somebody had to kill it.
Yeah, as long as it's not me, I'm cool with a big old steak.
Yeah, but if you think about it, you know, plants are living things. You know, you kill them to eat them.
I heard a green bean scream once when I bit into it.
Well, I don't know if I've ever heard that.
I'm kidding. Bob, how many deer have you killed, would you imagine, in over the course of the last 60 years hunting?
Probably 20, 25, somewhere in that range there.
And that's a pretty good amount?
I'm sorry?
That's a pretty good amount. I have no concept. So, I mean, I guess it's not that easy.
That's one every couple of years.
You don't get a deer every time you go out, correct?
Right.
No, absolutely not. And that's, you know, the biggest part of it is being out in the woods.
And avoiding Dick Cheney. Making sure he's not in your blind.
And freezing cold, it's still fun, you know? It's
right.
Just out there. The kill is the smallest part of the hunt.
It's the whole experience.
Yes, it is. The total experience, hunting with your buddies, you know, even though you're not sitting next to each other in a tree stand or wherever normally. But it's all about the experience. And it goes back a long, long time.
Well, so, happy hunting to you,
Bob. Caveman
Bob.
Days.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only sport you can go back to caveman days with.
Exactly right.
They played shuffleboard.
Oh, they played, right, those two.
The men drug their women around by their hair, yep. You know?
Well, you don't do that, I hope, Bob.
No, I stopped that a long time ago.
All right.
Goodness.
Tired of losing dates that way.
Tired of losing dates. Bob, thank you so much for calling. It's nice to hear his side of the story. Hunter for 60 years, never heard of that.
Yeah, how about that? All right, a quick break, some news, and then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder. We're moving on from one upsetting thing to another. In Ohio, there was a man on death row, and he had an execution that was supposed to happen in 2009, and it was botched, so he survived. And now he is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to declare that a second attempt to put him to death would be unconstitutional. Ryan Burrow is in the studio to talk about this.
Hey,
yeah,
Ryan.
Good afternoon. Yeah, kind of a really weird story. Do you guys remember this from 2009?
I do.
Ramel Broom.
Yeah, Ramel Broom. He was, first of all, he was convicted of taking a 14-year-old girl who was walking home in Ohio from a football game, raping her and killing her. This was in 1984. Never confessed to anything, and to this day says that he didn't do it. But he was sentenced to death, and in 2009, they gave it a good old hearty try. He was all strapped down for lethal injection. It took 2 hours. They poked him 18 times, could not find the vein, and eventually said, you know what, we're going to scrub this. Well, he's still on death row, still convicted of the crime, and the Ohio Supreme Court has determined we're going to give this another try. And their reasoning behind it is that while he was being poked, he was never actually administered the drug. So it's not as though they actually, you know, tried to execute him or were able to execute him because he never had the lethal dose inside of him. Because what the defense is saying is, hey, this is double jeopardy. This is cruel and unusual punishment. And this is unconstitutional. You should not be able to try this again. But the Ohio Supreme Court said, well, wait a minute. They were poking, but they never actually, you know, hit where they were supposed to. And while he complains about, you know, how difficult it was and how much pain he was in when they were poking him, when he is actually administered the drug, he will, you know, essentially die instantly and will feel no pain. So very, very interesting. Now it goes to the Supreme Court.
A couple of things. Thing number one is, for some reason, I was under the impression that if you were on death row and they made an attempt to end your life and it was unsuccessful, that that was the end of it, that you were free to leave. I don't know why
I told you that.
I don't know why I thought that, but was there a
free
time
to
where,
leave?
Yeah.
To get out of prison?
There's been one other person who survived an execution attempt. We don't really have much of the backstory, but we know that in this case, this was the first time it was involving a lethal injection.
Yeah.
And this case right here, I mean, it threw everything out of whack with lethal injections. Remember about getting the various drug the right way, the three-dose cocktail
right.
and everything like that. And to be honest with you, there are no lethal injections allowed right now in the United States until 2017 as a result, partially because of this and, you know, some of the concerns they have about the drugs that they use.
Do you know, it just hit me why. I read a book years and years ago where with a firing squad, that was their rule, that if the firing squad had their chance at you and were unsuccessful, that's it. You get to go home.
Well, it's possible. The firing squad was, I mean, out west, I know Utah used it until maybe a decade ago. Yeah, or something like that. I don't know how often it was used, but it was still an option. But I guess if you survive that, go on. You
couldn't a good lawyer make, and I'm sure that this guy's lawyer is trying to make a similar argument, saying, you guys had your chance to fulfill the prophecy, and you failed at it, so...
The girl he raped and murdered didn't get a second chance, why should he?
14-year-old. Yeah,
terrible.
But he says that he still stands by the fact that... he never killed her. He never raped her. So, I mean, there's always that argument. He wants DNA testing. Obviously, this happened in 1984 before all the cool CSI stuff that we seem to have now.
They can do a DNA test that'll date back, can't they?
You would think so. But at this point, they're pretty determined that this conviction's already happened and we're going to move forward. So,
all right. Here. Oh, go on, Wendy.
No, I'm not sure how I feel about the death penalty anyway, because in cases that people have been executed, it turns out later they weren't guilty.
Right.
There's no taking that back.
We've seen that in Illinois, right?
Yes.
I mean, where we've, you know, can essentially put people on death row, but, you know, you sit there and nothing else happens.
So I'm not necessarily a fan of it or agree with it, but if it has come to this point, the person being executed should trust that they're not going to mess it up.
You would think.
I mean, that's terrible.
Right.
Yeah, the mentality of going in, you know, for that final. I mean, that's a mental exercise as much as it is a physical one, right? I mean, preparing to die, knowing that it's going to happen, you know, having that full, you know, walk down the hall and the meal and everything like that that we associate with.
Good news is he gets a bonus last meal.
Well, he's had 7 years of bonus last meals.
Yeah, but not the top of the line meal.
Why the last attempt to end him was 2009, 7 years ago. Why has it been 7 years in the middle there?
It's been because of court proceedings, things of that nature. It was just this spring that his attorneys went to the Ohio Supreme Court and said, you guys can't try this again. And that's when the Ohio Supreme Court said, well, yes, we can, based on the fact that you know, he was never actually injected with the dose.
So what were they doing when they were they were just trying to strictly find a vein? That's all they were doing?
Yeah.
They never...
Yeah, they couldn't find the vein, and so they pricked him 18 times.
God.
Sorry for those people who may be feeling a little woozy right now, but it took 2 hours, and they said during it he was screaming and yelling, and obviously, you know, like I said, probably physical pain is a lot of emotional pain at that time as well.
Why don't they sedate him then at this point? Maybe shot number two is sedation instead of waiting for 18 times. And then a lot of people are texting, why not a bullet after that?
Well, I don't think that's at their jurisdiction.
But you know what? Every state's rules on execution are different. Mm-hmm. Some are lethal injection. Some, as we pointed out, were firing squad until not that long ago. So it varies. And if you're in a state that only allows one specific type of execution, that you have to stick by that. That's it.
You got to get it right, though.
Yeah.
That's really terrible.
Yeah.
Bob, what do you think about this?
I think tough crap. The guy is on death row, for Pete's sakes. He's not on death row because he stole a pack of gum. He's on death row because he killed somebody and didn't give them any chance whatsoever. I don't care if it takes 50 tries. I don't care if it takes a bullet in the head. Kill him. be done with it. Plain and simple. That he was convicted, he should be put to death no matter how many times it takes. There is no such thing as cruel and unusual punishment when it comes to a murderer.
Except that they still have laws protecting. Even you would think to yourself, you've kind of given up on those rights if you're a murderer and a rapist and all the things this man seems to be. However, the laws still apply to him that they can't use cruel and unusual punishment, even though he's on death row.
Well, maybe there is laws like that. I'm sure there are, but there shouldn't be, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's ridiculous.
But then that makes us. As bad as he is by inflicting this pain and suffering. I mean, they should have just kept going and finished the job.
But if they couldn't, for whatever reason,
yeah,
maybe he was dehydrated. When you get dehydrated, your veins shrink. So maybe that's the reason they couldn't find a vein, whatever the case may be. It doesn't matter. They need to give him another try, and it's a third try if it takes that, or whatever it takes. He was convicted. You do the crime, you have to, you know.
Don't do the crime if you can't do the time. I hear you. Thank you, Bob.
I got a feeling 7 years later, if this does go through, and well, I guess that would be 8 years later, they're probably going to get it right if he does go. I would think that they're not going to
let this happen again.
Unless he's got super tiny veins that they just can't find. And even, I think they'll probably do a little scouting beforehand.
Yeah.
But it probably won't happen again. So this is his last shot to stay alive, I guess.
Is lethal injection anything like in the old firing squads? They said that, you know, one person didn't have a bullet, so you didn't quite know if you were the one who actually executed the person. Or with the electric chair, there were a couple of switches and three people hit them, and you don't know if yours was the one that sent the electric shock. Is it like that with lethal injection?
No, I mean, there's one administrator. I'm not exactly sure how it goes state by state for it, but you don't have like four people going up and giving a shot and, you know, one of them being the fatal one.
When I was doing the night show, we had a lady on one night who was, she worked for the state government and she was an official witness. And whenever that state put somebody to death, she was there. She had seen, I think, 27 or 28 over her career. And I said, does it ever get easier? And she said, no, you're watching somebody on their last few minutes. They know going in, it's their last few minutes on earth. And it's not. I mean, every time, it's shocking every single time.
If I recall, Susan Carlson over at NBC5 was one of the journalists who was at Timothy McVeigh.
I think you're right. I
believe that's the case. I spoke to her briefly about it a couple of years ago, but it'd be interesting to hear about.
I don't even like to see a dead animal on the side of the road. I can't. Yeah. I would never want to witness that, and I know what horrible crimes this guy is accused of, but still, I have compassion. I wouldn't want to witness that.
Yeah. So what happens next, Ryan? What are we waiting on?
It's going to go to Supreme Court. The High Court in Washington, D.C. will take a look, decide yay or nay, or decide, you know, we're going to punt on this and just let the Ohio ruling stand, which would be, at this point, that he will die.
Yeah. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's Ryan Burrow from our own news department here at WGN. We'll take a quick break and then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
All right, it's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder. Bill, do you misplace things?
Sometimes, sure.
Everybody does. You kind of like misplace something?
Yeah, there's a badge that we have here that gets us in and out of the building, and I lose it all the time.
I think Kevin was witness to it one day. It might have been yesterday. I was looking for my phone.
Yeah.
And you said, you look like Bill. Did you say that?
Yeah, the cargo shorts you wear, Bill, he always loses things in the cargo shorts.
Right.
I think my husband has topped all of you.
Because why? What is he losing?
He's losing his mind, but then being married to me is not always easy.
Yeah.
He lost his wallet and all of his keys. And the fact that they're
all
both...
All at one time?
Well, the fact that they're both lost makes me think that they're in the house somewhere.
Right, right. Can I tell you the two places that whenever I lose something...
Please tell me.
I'll tell you where they are all the time.
The refrigerator?
Yeah, on top of the refrigerator... Not in the refrigerator. Why does he? Do you guys lose stuff inside?
I don't
your
know,
refrigerator?
But just sometimes your mind wanders. Sometimes, like I have found myself, like I come home from the store and I'll put my keys in the refrigerator and the milk on the counter.
Oh.
It's like, wait a minute, that's wrong.
I don't think I've ever lost anything inside, but I'm the perfect height. I'm 5'11". I'm the perfect height to where I put stuff on there because it's a flat surface and there's nothing obstructing it. So I'll put something, keys, wallet, whatever. and then open the refrigerator and get whatever I want, and then I've lost whatever's up there. So a lot of times...
All right, we'll look there.
It's up on top of the refrigerator. And the other one is that part of the car that I call the Bermuda Triangle, which is between the driver's seat and the passenger seat, and not quite where that console is in the middle. But there's like some that's like kind of underneath the two seats.
I know what you're talking about. There's a little hiding spot.
I've got... Like anything that's missing, that's where I need to look.
You found
that's
your
where,
wife there once.
That's
didn't you?
Where Terry was hiding. Yeah.
We looked there because we the one new car is a keyless start, but the key has to be in the vehicle.
Sure.
So I said, Jim, go in the car and hit the start button and see if
see
it
if
starts.
It'll start up. Smart.
Because if it does, then you know the keys are in there.
Yeah.
Not in there. Huh. And I, you know, if it's usually the phone that he can't find.
Right.
And yeah. then I say, do you have the Find My iPhone app on? And he goes, of course I don't. But the fact that the keys and the wallet are missing.
That's good news, I guess.
Well, I think so. But we're getting to the point where I'm like, okay, we should call and cancel credit cards and
yeah.
stuff. But he's like.
Oh, has it been that long? How long has he been without these things?
Well, he went. What is today? Wednesday?
Uh-huh.
He went Monday night to get school supplies with Dylan. And he needed the keys. To get home.
Right. So you know he had
them
there.
And he needed the wallet to purchase things. And I said, did you, when you were loading the car, did you put them on top of the car? And he said, no, because then the car wouldn't have started.
Right. No. My keyless.
Yeah, it would have started and then you drive away.
Right.
See, that's what I'm thinking. Because they're both missing.
Hmm.
If it was one, I would say, oh, well, he dropped them somewhere.
Right.
We have looked everywhere. Falling short of looking through the garbage, which I have found things in the past.
Sure, sometimes.
Seriously, when you have things in your hands, sometimes you let go of one thing when you don't mean it.
Right.
Look through all the school supplies. I don't know where they are, and it's driving me nuts.
One of the biggest differences between Terry and myself is that when I lose something, I need to find it immediately, because that's all I'll focus on is
yeah.
I have to have that thing. And Terry, no matter what it is, no matter how important it is, she always says this, it'll turn up, and then just goes on with her day.
That's what Jim's been doing, and they're not even my keys and wallet. And all of us, Michael, Dylan, and I have been just ripping the house apart looking for it. Dylan's out with a flashlight last night. I said, it's your first day of school on Wednesday. You have to go to bed. He goes, I got to find Dad's wallet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why do you want to steal from him? I mean, I honestly, you guys have got to just get a purse. At least with us, we may not be able to find it in our purse,
but it's in there.
We know it's in there.
Right. My mom always used to do this thing where she would pray to St. Anthony, who is the patron saint of lost things. So she would spend a minute just talking to this guy, St. Anthony. I don't know what good that did. I'd always go, well, that's a couple minutes now. You missed out on the search party. Get St. Anthony over here. Get him to work.
I can't. I don't even know where to look. So that's what I need help with. But I'll look on top of the refrigerator. I will text
him. Now, you know, they do these things now. It's essentially like a load jack for everything you own. It's this little chip that you can attach to everything from car keys to sunglasses to
the
whatever.
Children?
You could probably put one on your kid.
On
I
their
guess.
Belt?
I guess so. And then you hit a button and then it emits some sort of a noise so that you can find it.
Well, what good does that do me now? It's already lost.
Yeah, I guess you'd need it prior to losing the item.
This is going to drive me nuts. It's been since Monday night, so we're getting on, you know.
3 days.
Yeah.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. That's a long time.
And I'm like, do you have any money? No.
And there's no fear that somebody could find your keys. Is it just for the car or is it the house too?
It's all of our keys and it's his whole wallet. But that's what I mean since they're missing together. We checked the workout bag because he's like, I went to the gym.
Right.
I looked in there.
Did he talk to management there and say, did anybody turn these
no,
in?
No, because he had to drive after
oh,
the
he
health
had to
club.
Have left.
He went to Walgreens to get the school supplies because
right.
Target was out of them.
Yeah, so he needed the keys certainly to
I
get
mean.
Back home.
And he all paid right. for it. And I said, well, call the last place you were and see if it was there.
Yeah.
This is going to drive me nuts.
It'll turn up, says
okay,
my
Terry.
Wife, chippily.
Chippily.
Yeah.
All right, quick break. News coming your way. And what have you lost? And where can I look? Because I need help. This
sure.
I called today. I said, have you found any luck? He goes, nah.
And that
are
was
you,
it.
I said, are you looking? Well, yeah.
He doesn't seem that upset.
I swear to God, we have looked at every place. Really, except maybe the top of the refrigerator.
Look up
I will
there.
Text
Look
him.
Up there. All right, a quick break and then more show. Give us a call at 312-981-7200 if you can find your phone. It's WGN. Are you trying to figure out the significance of this song?
Yeah, I love this little game that we play with our producer, Kevin Richter.
Kevin, you want to give Wendy a clue?
Do you get it, Bill?
No. I do not.
You want to give Bill a clue?
It's a song by the Pixies.
Yeah.
Called?
Lost Keys.
Where is My Mind?
Where is My Mind? It all ties in. Are you impressed?
Yeah.
Kind of? Yeah,
I'm
a little bit?
I'm just worried. Missing keys, missing wallet since Monday night. Looked all over the place. They're both missing. So
yeah.
Usually it's one item, like you lose your phone or you lose your keys or you lose your wallet. He does have cargo shorts.
But not necessarily because, you know, he obviously had all these things together in the same place.
Oh, he has nothing together.
Oh, he doesn't? All right. All right.
I'm kidding.
By the way, you showed me your keys, and I've never seen anybody with more keys than you have. How many keys do you have on your keychain? It's like the keys from a Victor Hugo novel. Like if you were a jailer in a Victor Hugo novel, you'd walk around the cells with those keys. You have at least a dozen keys on your keychain.
Well, I have a fob and a remote start for one car.
Yeah.
I have a fob and a key for another car.
Yeah.
And then I have my house key.
Uh-huh.
Front and back.
Uh-huh.
So that's two.
Yeah.
I don't know what that one is.
See, that's what I mean. If there's a key that you don't know what it is, you should probably discard it, right?
Well, no, because what if I need it? Then my sister's house, my cousin's house.
You have keys to all your relatives' houses?
Our office key.
Yeah.
I don't know which one that is.
All right. What are all those other ones? There's like a dozen keys on there.
I just explained. My house, two for my house, my sister, my cousin.
Yeah. What about the other ones?
Not really sure. But I can't get rid of them. Shut up.
You don't know.
I'm not really sure.
Hey, you got my house key on there. How'd that happen?
Well, in case you lock yourself out.
Oh, no.
I just, you know, since Monday night, went to get school supplies. Jimmy Mack comes home, can't find his keys or his wallet. Sue, you have a couple places he can look?
I do. Here's the first one. Inside the bags, wherever the school supplies were.
Good idea.
Already looked in there.
No.
Okay. All right. Second one. Whatever he was wearing, whatever has pockets, shirt, his cargo shorts, if he threw it down the laundry, did you check the entire laundry basket?
No.
Look in there. That's a good idea,
too. That is a good idea.
A friend found her phone in there, so that's worked in the past.
I just, you know, I'm not blaming men, but they don't have a purse like we do, Sue, so they should really start wearing a merce.
A man's purse?
I mean, because really, and there are times I can't find things in my purse, but I know it's in there.
Yeah, right.
They it's need, true. Like, maybe men should start wearing fanny packs. Maybe you guys could bring that back
in
style.
Oh, that
is a good look. So, I'm not thinking that's going to work so well.
Probably not. Thank you so much. Jerry, what did your wife lose? So I guess women lose things, too.
It was an engagement ring. We were at a party a long way from home, and it snowed about a foot. And I had been drinking. She did not. So she said, "You drive," or "You sit down, I'll drive." And she cleaned the car off, drove us home over an hour. Next morning, the engagement ring is gone.
Oh, no.
What, did she take it off at the party? Were you guys having a key party or something?
No. Not a key party and not a ring party, but it was gone. So since it was so far, I called my friend. I said, "Please look for a hole in the snow," which was just wasn't going to work.
Were you still drunk when you made that request?
No, I actually drove over and looked myself, couldn't find it, came home, searched everywhere, searched her car everywhere. And at that point, I thought we were going to give up. But I mean, we stripped the bed, everything. I searched the car a second time, and then I searched it a third time, and I finally found it underneath the driver's seat. It had fallen between the seat and the console and jumped up into the track that the driver's seat slides on.
So if you put your hand under the seat, you wouldn't have felt it.
Right, and that was the third time I did it, but I ran my fingers up and down that track, and there it was.
All right.
It's worth it, Wendy. That stuff gets lost in there all the time.
Jimmy has as many keys as I have.
Oh.
It was my fault for drinking because her hands got cold because she had to clean the snow off the car, and that's why the ring fell off.
Oh, makes sense. Yeah, because your fingers shrink up in the winter. She needs to get that resized, Jerry.
Yeah, as far as keeping your keys in a found condition once you do find them, I bought a little valet box and have it on the wall. It's decorative, and hang my keys in there. And I'm not leaving home without them because I can't start the car. So, having a system like that, I've found to be foolproof for us. It works for us.
But, Jerry, here's the thing. You have to remember to hang the keys up. That's where the problem lies.
Yeah, my wife hasn't figured that out. I use it religiously. So.
Thank you so very much. Paul has something interesting. Hey, Paul, you have an app that can help you find lost things?
Yeah, so this is cool, and it's not a paid sponsor. Of course, we got to throw that out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's called Tile. So last winter, or actually this past winter here in February, I was out in Wisconsin. I lost my keys. Couldn't figure out where they were. But I had this little app that somebody told me about last October to get. $25 for the year. This thing's the size of a poker chip. You could put it in your wallet, in your car, in case you lose that. You could put it on your keychain. And what happens is when you lose something, like your wallet or wherever this thing is at, you go to an app on your phone or on your computer, and it tells you within about 4 yards of where this thing is, where you lost it.
It just emits a signal
like
that you're...
Like a GPS kind of thing, huh?
Exactly. It emits a signal, and it's good for the year. So it's just a little, it's like a little, I don't know what causes it to power up, but it's just like a little frequency that comes out of there for the year, $25. And for the year, and that's it. So I lost the keys. I was freaking out. I found them. It was within about 3 or 4 yards where I lost it. And just last week at Ogilvy in the restroom there, oh, man, I did something. I don't know how I did it or what I did. I lost the keys. They were gone. I went to the app, and it showed the keys were in the back room by the dock. I dropped the keys in the trash can.
Well, so you were probably using a paper towel.
What's that?
When you were using a paper towel to dry your hands, maybe you threw them. See?
Yeah.
I got to check the garbage.
Now, Paul, this is the question that needs to be asked, and I'm sure you thought about this. What if you lose your phone? Then you're in trouble.
Well, then you go back to your app, or you find my iPhone or find my Android. Android's got that. You
can do it on another computer. It doesn't have to be on your phone. Okay, I get it.
That's right. So this thing is very cool. I've got it.
Tile.
Things often. Tile.
Yeah.
It'll be the new friend of the family. So
wow, that's not bad for 25 a year.
Hey, check it out. It's I don't work for him. I had it.
Yeah.
I thought this is a great idea. So I hope Jimmy Mack finds that stuff and the marriage doesn't dissolve or anything.
Yeah, that's
that would be terrible.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it. It's not going to dissolve.
Oh,
but,
you don't
I
know.
Mean, it's just frustrating to me.
Sure it is.
I already have two boys to take care of. I don't need a third.
Yeah, you don't need a third. No.
Mike, where'd you find your daughter's keys?
Oh, I found them in the refrigerator. I came home from work. I see my wife and my daughter searching for the keys and everything. She's sleepful. One time we found milk in the food pantry and everything. Middle night, she gets up, and I walk past the refrigerator. I said, wait a minute. I opened the refrigerator. Where the milk was supposed to be, her keys were sitting right there. She was looking for 2.5 hours.
See, but that happens. Sometimes your brain is not working, and you put your keys where the milk's supposed to be.
Right.
All right, we'll check the fridge. Thank you.
Do you know where Terry has left her keys more? Like, anytime her keys are lost, I know when I lose stuff, I know where to go. Whenever Terry's keys are lost, they're always in the same place. They're in the front door. Because she's coming in with groceries or something and puts the keys in and opens the door.
And leaves them there.
And then closes the door, and that's where they are.
Yeah, I think we checked that, too. Because that is usually where he leaves them.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know. It's not my wallet.
Are you guys, you're not fighting over this.
No, I just am concerned.
Sure. And I'm not trying to scare you, but if he did have them somewhere outside of the house, although I don't know that that's possible, he got in the house. I'm concerned because his wallet is with the keys, and if somebody does find that somewhere, they know where he lives.
Well, if you do, just open the door, hang the keys up by the front door, and leave the wallet.
And get out. Don't take anything else. You'll be fine. I'm sure they'll turn up.
Yeah.
I'm sure. A quick break. More show coming your way next. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
All right, looking for some keys and a wallet. I've just checked; no other charges have gone through or anything.
That's a good sign.
They have to be in the house, them.
Right? They're in the house.
Yeah, but when will they surface and where will they be?
I don't know that they ever will, but they're in your house.
That's good to know.
That's good to know, right?
Hi, listener Bill. How are you?
Fine. How about yourself?
Pretty decent.
Flustered. Are you flustered?
Well, I just like to have everything situated. I like to know where things are, Bill.
I'm sorry?
I like to know where things are. You found a wallet?
Yeah, I was going down the street by a local gas station, and I looked in the middle of the road. There was a wallet, so I stopped and I picked it up, and there was like $130 in it. And a bunch of credit cards and, you know, gift cards and stuff like that. And turned out the lady lived about 30 miles from where I found the wallet. So I went out to her house and waited an hour, and nobody came home. And was on my way home, and the credit card company called and said that they found the lady. So I went back to the gas station, met up with her, and gave her back her wallet and all her goodies.
That's the nicest thing you can do for somebody. I bet she was thrilled, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. She was tickled.
Yeah, because you don't expect, once you lose something like that, you go, well, that's gone forever. I'm down everything. I can't get that back. It's what a nice surprise. Good for you. Very nice of you.
Well, you know, it's nothing less than I would expect somebody else to do.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Bill. You give me hope.
False hope.
This is the funniest text ever.
What does
this
say?
I'm sorry, and I don't know if this is from a guy, but I'm assuming, and you shouldn't assume.
Right.
Because it makes an ass out of you and me, Bill.
Wait a minute. My ASSU. Oh, yeah, it does.
But 262 says, lost my wallet all winter until I went golfing the next spring, found it in my golf bag.
Oh, yeah, sure.
How did you go all winter? Obviously, you got new credit cards.
You'd have to, yeah, but I could see that happening. Seasonal like that, sure.
All right, and Harold found his keys.
How's it going?
Good, Harold. How are you?
So you said he got home and he came in with his keys.
Right.
So you're sure they're there? So they're there.
He opened the door. He unlocked the door.
Yeah. You just got to go. You got to take every piece of furniture, take the cushions out, dump them out, turn it upside down.
Do you have a fine tooth comb, Wendy? You need a fine tooth comb.
I do have a fine tooth
comb.
Use
that.
All right.
So I lost a set of keys, and I use a fanny pack because I'm tired of, like, I've got a phone and a couple iPods.
So you're the one. You're the one guy who still uses a fanny pack, huh?
I'm sorry, but if you want to call it a different name, let's call it a different name, then we'll be happy, but...
But it's a fanny pack.
I got some ribbon by a girl one time. She was like in a car. She pulls up and I'm like, hey, you know, this stuff is going to pull my pants down otherwise. It really does. How many keys you got? You got 12? I've had at one point, like 25
what?
Keys in my ring. Yep.
You're going to get a hernia.
Yeah.
Hisnia. It's a boy. All right, Harold. So you lost your keys.
So what I would do is I had a fairly big key ring on there, so I would slip the fanny pack strap through it.
This is hot.
I put it on, and then it would hang there.
Like a janitor, like you'd have keys hanging from your fanny pack.
Sure.
Oh yeah. Somebody said that one time. Some of my girlfriend's boss says, "Oh, are these your jailer's keys?" And I said, "No, I think they're janitor's keys." But anyways. I'm on the bus coming home from my brother's house, and I'm on the bus and talking to my girlfriend, and I undo the buckle on that pack.
Because it's terribly uncomfortable and ugly.
Yeah, well, sorry. I got to tell you. Now that we have iPhones, we need something more than just... But anyways, so we're going, and about a half an hour later, get up off the bus and... go home, and we get to the house, and I'm like, "Where's the keys?" I'm like, "Oh man, where?" Oh, I'm like, "Oh, I don't have my keys."
And then all of a sudden it occurs to me what I did. And I said, they're on that bus.
Oh, no.
Bus is long gone. So I'm like, oh, you know what? I walk back. I'm only 2 blocks from the bus stop. So I go back. And I said, I know that bus has only got to go about 2 miles down the road. And then it turns around. So I got to catch that bus on the way back. So about a half an hour, 40 minutes later, bus comes. I get on the bus. I tell them what I got to do. I go check where I sat. No keys, not like that. I go back and I get off the bus at the next block, and I wait for the next one. Next bus comes. The bus comes. I says, hey, do you mind if I, and the bus driver reaches down, and he pulls up a set of keys. And he goes, you lose these? And I go, yep.
Did you give him a reward?
Yes, I did. I bought him lunch.
Very nice.
That's pretty sweet. Well, a happy ending to your story, Harold. Thank you. I hope we have a happy ending.
I hope you do.
And I hope we find the keys.
Yes. All right, a quick break and then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN. All right, I think you're going to enjoy this. I found this over at MSN over the weekend. It has to do with the value of a dollar, not just today, but they went all the way back to 1945 over at MSN, and they said, what could somebody possibly buy for a dollar? If you had a dollar in 1945, what could you purchase with it?
I bet a lot.
A lot more than today. Way, way, way more than today. A lot of times when they give you the dollar value of something, of course it's in current dollars, but if it's a story that dates back, they'll try to make that transition for you, and they'll say, well, this is in $1962 or in $1984 as opposed to today.
Are you trying to rub this in because Jim lost his wallet?
Yes. Yes, that was my purpose. No, you know what made me think of this is I don't remember how this came up on the show, but a couple weeks ago I was telling you about a McDonald's ad I remembered from when I was a kid where they touted the fact that you get an entire meal at McDonald's. You could get a cheeseburger, a Coke and fries, and then get change back from your dollar.
And you were alive when this was going on?
Oh, yeah. This would have been probably 1970 or 1971. The commercial that they ran all the time for McDonald's was just that. Come on in, get a meal, get a cheeseburger, fries, and a Coke, and change back for your dollar. It'd be hard to pull that off today.
Yeah.
Although they still do have a fairly extensive dollar value
it's
meal.
It's not really a dollar menu, Bill. Honest to God, like the McDouble is like $1.19.
It's a little more, and it doesn't include drinks and fries.
No, but all drinks are a dollar.
Right.
That's so, and you know what I noticed in the South when we were in Nashville? They did not have the, like, a medium Coke was like $2.39.
It wasn't a dollar there? Well, I wonder why that would be.
Not at various locations. Because you're so used to, like, only spending a dollar on a Coke. But
Right. All right, so I'll go back to 1945. That's where they do it on MSN, and it tells you what you could or could not purchase for a dollar. In 1945, you could buy 4 paperback copies of a book. A book in paperback form was a quarter, so you could get 4 of those, 4 books for a dollar. Now a paperback book is almost the same price of what I was used to paying for a hardcover book. I got a book on vacation. It was $8.95. A paperback was $8.95. That seems a little much.
My God, how'd you afford it?
I couldn't eat that night. We had no food that night.
Weren't comic books like a quarter when you started buying them, like the Archies?
A dime. I bought some for a dime.
You're
back
older
when I was
than
a kid.
I am. I
no,
think.
I'm younger. I'm way younger.
6 months.
In 1946, you could buy a man's flannel shirt for a dollar. You could get a nice shirt for a buck back in 1946.
Boy, too bad there weren't any Nirvana fans back then.
Well, you know what's funny? Whenever my dad talks about the price of our house, we had a fairly decent sized house that they bought for just over $20,000 in 1969. You know?
God.
So now, like, good luck with that today. Try buying a fairly decent sized house for $20,000+.
You can't even get like a trailer for $20,000, can you?
Well, I guess you know, probably not, but I remember my mom always complaining about the monthly, you know,
the mortgage.
And I said,
"What was
to her,
it like $650?
Well, yeah, it wasn't expensive at all by today's standards.
Yeah,
you know?
Yes.
In 1947, you could buy 8 cans of Heinz cream of tomato soup for a dollar.
So and you're set for a couple of weeks.
12 cents each, right? You got all the food you need. In 1948, you get 5 boxes of Kellogg's cornflakes. They were 20 cents each back in 1948.
Wow! Now cereal's like 4 something
it's
a box.
A lot more expensive. In 1949, you could purchase 7 loaves of bread for a dollar. In 1950, 4 pounds of frozen green beans would cost you a buck.
How many pounds?
4 pounds. 4 pounds of green beans for a dollar. In 1951, you could buy a package of 25 Christmas cards for a dollar.
Jeez.
They were that inexpensive. In 1952, a little under 3 pounds of coffee could be yours for just a dollar.
Wow, that's changed.
I know. 1953, 24 pounds of potatoes.
Potatoes are still cheap, but not that cheap.
Not like that. That's almost free. That's just above free. In 1954, a 1 pound T-bone steak would set you back a dollar.
Jeez.
In 1955, a Slinky. It's weird that they went from so many food items to a Slinky.
Yeah, and think about it. You could get like a 1 pound T-bone steak or a Slinky.
Right.
I'd rather go T-bone.
It's up to you. These are the options on our menu today. We're having a special. It's either a T-bone steak or a Slinky. One of them walks downstairs alone or in pairs. It's up to you to guess which one it is. In 1956, 15 eggs would cost you a dollar.
Why did you get 15? Didn't they come as a dozen?
No, I'm sure they were a dozen, but at that point, a dozen eggs were probably 88 cents something, so they just prorated it. In 1957, one bath towel would cost you a buck. In 1958, 25 pounds of celery, which is, in my opinion, way too much celery.
What do you do with by about 25 pounds?
I don't know. Seven cans of cream corn in 1959, and in 1960, Del Monte peaches, three of those. You get three cans of Del Monte peaches for a dollar. Four boxes of Cheerios in 1961. In 1962, five fast food hamburgers. So that's a McDonald's or a Burger King in 1962.
Yeah, somebody just texted 1958 at McDonald's, 15 cents for a hamburger, 20 cents a shake, 10 cents fries, 2 cents tax, 3 cents back from 50 cent a piece.
I remember signs. I don't remember the McDonald's by us, but it was hamburgers were 29 cents and cheeseburgers were 34 cents. They charge you an extra 5 cents on the cheese.
I know, which kills me.
But that keeps going up and up and up and up.
It's at least 10 cents for a piece of cheese. Just bring it home and slap a Kraft single on it.
I think it's more, isn't it more than just 10 cents difference now between a cheeseburger and a regular hamburger at McDonald's or Burger King? I think it's more than that. I think. In 1963, you could purchase 3 pints of blueberries for a dollar.
Not anymore.
No, those days are long, long, long gone.
Produce is so expensive.
It is. And just the regular, not the organic
stuff.
I know. 1964, a ticket for one car to get into a drive-in movie theater. So that's unlimited patrons. You know, if you could stack 6 or 8 or 10 people in your car, they would charge you by the carload. That would run you a dollar in 1964.
Good value.
That's tremendous value. In 1965, you could buy 80 ounces of frozen French fries.
50 cents for a piece of cheese at McDonald's, by the way.
Yeah, that's the difference between a hamburger and a cheeseburger now. So back when we were kids, that difference was 5 cents.
Yeah.
Now it's 50 cents for that slice
Just
of
bring
cheese.
Bring your own cheese.
Bring your own cheese. Save some money. 4 loaves of bread in 1967 would run you a dollar.
And that's down from 7 loaves a couple years earlier had read.
Right.
So already it's starting to show.
Now here's the one that I find most alarming, and this is the one that I used to see with my very eyes quite regularly, and it still holds up today. The price of a Hershey bar. Remember, they would always increase it. It was an extra 3 cents or 5 cents. Like most candy when I was a kid, if you went to the candy aisle, almost all candy was 10 cents.
Well,
some of the higher grade
stores,
was 15.
Right?
Yeah. But even like a Jewel or similar stores.
10 cents.
Yeah,
God, honest,
all the candy.
You sound like you're like 80.
I'm not that old. I don't think. Maybe I am. But I remember like all that candy that you could get was 10 cents and some of the premium items were 15 cents. And now it's skyrocketed. But in 1968, you could get 20 Hershey bars.
Oh, for a buck?
They were 5 cents each in 1968. Yeah, because I still remember like when I was buying my own stuff, like I started buying my own stuff when I was 5 or 6 or 7.
What?
That's when I had...
You had a job?
Yeah, I worked I was a lathe operator.
I know you didn't go to kindergarten.
Sade
were...
wrote a song about me. Did you ever hear that song?
No.
Lathe operator. That's written about me.
You didn't go to kindergarten, went right to first grade because you were very smart.
Right.
You're ambidextrous.
Right.
And now you had a job as a lathe operator at age 5 and bought
press.
Your own candy.
I'd buy my own candy.
That's why I didn't know how much it was because at that point I'd go shopping with my mom.
My mom wouldn't buy my candy. I was on my own. I lived on my own. I had my own apartment.
At 5.
Yeah, in a wagon. Girls Love the Wagon. So when the price went up to 10 cents, I remember there was a panic, a national panic.
Did you say, this is a travesty?
This is a travesty, I said, as a small boy, and I wore a monocle back then. But people were so upset. They're like, we're only paying 5 cents for Hershey bars. This 10 cent stuff is nonsense. But back in 1968, they were a nickel each. You could get 20 of them for a dollar.
Wow.
Go in today. Tell them you have a coupon. See if they'll honor the coupon.
Who needs 20 at once?
It does seem excessive, doesn't it?
Yeah. What year are we at?
We're now in 1969, Wendy, when you could get 3 gallons of gas for a dollar. Three. Gas was 33 cents a gallon.
Yeah, that's... I don't remember that at all.
And our car ran on Hershey bars. My dad had it modified so our car would run on Hershey bars. He was a visionary. In 1970,
he was the Elon Musk before there was Elon Musk.
He was our first Elon Musk. A tube of Crest toothpaste in 1970 would run you a dollar.
Really?
For a tube of toothpaste.
Four out of five dentists surveyed.
Right. They would agree. All right, let's take a quick break and then more of these. Just to show you the value of a dollar and how it's changed, stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Abba dabba doo. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Boy, what a dollar buys you today is nothing compared to back in the 70s or the 60s or the 50s or the 40s when you could buy a car and a house.
No, you couldn't.
For a dollar.
Both?
Yeah. If you bought a car, they'd throw in a house. In 1971, three pounds of cranberries could be yours for just a dollar. Two cantaloupes in 1972.
Hey, nice cantaloupes.
Yes. Well, thank you. That would cost you a buck. And then the lawsuit, that would also cost you a dollar.
You could get an attorney for a dollar for the whole case.
Right. Right. Peter Francis Geraci's father would help you out. One box of Eggo frozen waffles, Wendy, for a buck back in 1973.
Those are still good today, I got to tell
you. They hold up nicely.
They're not a dollar a box, though.
And then in 1974, we come back to McDonald's. One Big Mac and one hamburger. You could get a sidecar.
What do you need a hamburger after a Big Mac?
I don't know. I would do one or the other, not both. But say you brought a friend with you.
Who gets the Big Mac and the friend gets the terrible burger?
I guess that doesn't seem fair, does it? But all that for a dollar back in 1974. You could get a bottle of NyQuil for a dollar in 1975.
Cheap buzz.
Yes. Same for 1976, a package of Oreo cookies.
Wow.
Would be a dollar. 1977, a box of Bisquick for a buck. 1978, 1 pound of ground beef.
That's cheap.
Yeah, for just a dollar for a pound. A bottle of Hershey syrup in 1979 would run you a dollar. And in 1980, 2 pounds of turkey.
Really?
Yep. Or you could wait a year and get 2 pounds of bluebonnet margarine for a dollar in 1981. That's what a lot of families opted to do. Do we want to spend our money now or wait just one more year and get a whole big tub of margarine? In 1982, you need something to wash that margarine down with, a 1 liter bottle of Coca-Cola for a dollar.
We were just out of high school then.
It still amazes me today that almost any store, I'll use Jewel as an example because that's the one that's closest to me. It's cheaper for you to buy a whole bunch of Coca-Cola than it is to buy a whole bunch of water.
When it's on sale.
But there's always either Coke or Pepsi is always on sale. The stores flip-flop it.
You can get a case of water for $2.99 if you're not into like a brand name.
Can you?
Yeah, yeah. $3.99. I think Dasani's like $4.99 for a 12er.
Made by Coke.
Yeah.
Yeah. But more times than not, like if we're having a party or something, or if we just want to buy a lot of beverages to make ourselves feel important,
mm-hmm.
I have found that buying, you know, you buy like a couple of 24 can containers of Coke. Yeah, you could say a case. All right, let's say a case. That's cheaper than buying a case of water. That shouldn't be. Water should be the cheapest drink in the world, shouldn't it? It comes right out of your faucet.
I don't know. We haven't had water here since January.
It's been a long time. It has been a long time. 7 ears of corn, Wendy, in 1983.
What if you had 8 people in your family?
Someone has to go hungry.
Or you cut it and you can just break it in half.
Right, right. A box of Kleenex would cost you a dollar in 1984, and in 1985, a half a gallon of milk. That's gone up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. A pound of kiwi fruit in 1986 is a dollar. Two cans of SpaghettiOs in 1987.
With or without meatballs?
I think just the plain.
Yeah, that's not worth
it. Does the one with meatballs cost more? I think it's the same, isn't it?
I think it's a couple cents
is
more.
Is it more? Yeah. You could get just under a pound and a half of a roasted chicken in 1988.
Just under a pound and right. a half.
Right. Don't go crazy with the roasted chicken. Just get what you need.
I feel like this whole list has taken really weird numbers for things. Like 8 pounds of cranberries.
Right. I mean,
wasn't there another object, like a singular object they could have chosen?
Yeah, Kevin, you know what? You're right about that. And I don't want anyone to think that's the only thing you could buy for a dollar in these years. Because there were other things, certainly. But I don't know why they chose the items that they
did. Yeah, I agree.
I'm most disturbed by the 2 pounds of Bluebonnet margarine, and I can't explain why. I just picture, for some reason, I picture a grandmother giving a small child a buck and saying, and I better see 2 pounds of Bluebonnet margarine or there'll be hell to pay.
Everything's better with Bluebonnet on it.
A box of Pop-Tarts. Or Pop-Tarts, as they used to call them. Pop-Tarts were a dollar in 1989.
That's a good deal.
But they only had like 6 or 8 flavors back then. Now you just mention any word in the English language and they have that flavor Pop-Tart.
Rhubarb.
Rhubarb Pop-Tarts are not good. Very sick. You get very sick from eating rhubarb Pop-Tarts. 1990.
You can't even say it, rhubarb.
It's too disgusting.
RuPaul
Pop-Tarts. In 1990, you could get 2 cans of tuna, Wendy. 2 cans of tuna
That's
for only a dollar.
That's pretty cheap, although I hate tuna.
Tuna's still cheap, but it's cat food, basically, isn't it?
Totally it totally is.
You're eating cat food. Do we have any tuna sponsors, by the way, Kevin, or did we have any? No? They're gone? Now, can we take Jody, because I don't know. Yeah, I guess this must be true. Why would you call in if this isn't true, right?
Hi, Jody.
Yeah, hi.
What would be a dollar back in 1966?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I started working downtown in 1966.
Yeah.
And I could get on the CTA with a transfer for 35 cents. A pack of cigarettes was 25 cents, and a gallon of gas was 25 cents.
So how about that?
You could do all of that for under a dollar. Yeah, I remember paying a quarter for the bus and 10 cents for the transfer to the L. And then we would get, if he wanted a pack of cigarettes, there was a quarter, and then a gallon of, everything was kind of like a quarter back then.
And back then, to ride the L, it was a mandate, you had to smoke on there. They wouldn't let you on it if you didn't smoke.
back then we had ashtrays at every desk, and to think of it now, all of those carcinogens we were.
Oh, I know.
All over the place.
Yeah, that's why stuff was so cheap. They knew you weren't going to live forever. They're like, hey, just live it up.
Thank you, Jody.
Enjoy yourself.
Okay,
have a good one.
I just want to point out one other quick thing. As I mentioned, in 1982, a 1 liter bottle of Coca-Cola would run you a buck. But then in 1992, 10 years later, a 2 liter bottle would cost you a dollar. So how did that happen? You're getting twice as much 10 years later. Wait a minute.
The 10-year special.
Something's wrong.
10-year anniversary, yeah.
A 1 liter bottle in 1982 cost you a dollar, but in 1992, a 2 liter bottle cost
you. That was for Coca-Cola?
Yeah.
Was it like newer? I mean, obviously it was, but.
It shows you that
the price of everything went up, but Coke, for some reason, you were getting twice as much for your money.
They started using cheaper ingredients.
Maybe.
Is that what it is?
Well, they made a 2 liter bottle at that point, and people were used to paying a dollar. I would have paid $2 for it.
That's the only value on it. Everything else has gone up, but that one, for some reason, is half the price 10 years later.
And does it have, like, current year? Because what can you get for a dollar today? Yeah. Can't even get a dollar for a dollar today.
Today, it lists. No, actually, you know what? It says in 2015, it goes up to 2015, a slice of New York pizza is a dollar.
Where?
In New York.
No way.
Uh-uh.
In New York.
There is nowhere you can get a dollar piece of pizza.
You're looking for a $5 with a soda special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're liars.
Are they lying?
The whole thing is
2016, you can get a gallon of Coca-Cola for a dollar.
Yeah.
It keeps going down.
That does seem really cheap, doesn't it?
You cannot get a piece of pizza anywhere for a dollar. Can
a
you think
dollar?
Of one place?
I don't. Yeah,
not even like at a little Roach Coach or whatever. You're not supposed to call it that. But, you know, there's little, like, vendors and stuff. You still can't get a pizza for a dollar.
That doesn't sound right. It does not sound right to me.
But free Coke.
Yeah, yeah.
Now
Coke,
it's free.
Now they pay you if you want to take a liter of Coke. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll find out what Ro and Anna have next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.